You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Welcome. It's nice to have you here. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will.
This week in Radical History for May 25.
Little surprises around every corner, but nothing dangerous.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
Once again, I'm Barron Segments, produced from the Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio, including these two short segments you'd love to hear.
On this day, May 25th, in 1861, U.S. President Abraham Lincoln overstepped his constitutional authority and in effect suspended the law of habeas corpus. A Maryland supporter of the Confederacy by the name of John Merryman had tried to disrupt Union troop movements and was detained by military officers. Ordinarily, such a detainee would be remanded to the custody of civilian courts and charged with a crime. But Lincoln intervened to allow Merryman to remain in military custody, where he was held without specific charges. A later Supreme Court ruling found that Lincoln had violated Merryman's constitutional rights. Yet the mass detention of Japanese citizens during World War II and the Bush administration's holding of an undisclosed number of citizens in facilities like the Guantanamo prison at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba have tested that same legal precedent.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, May 25th in 1936, the Remington Rand strike began when a federal labor union organized its workers against the anti-union policies and actions of the typewriter company Remington Rand. The strike infuriated the Rand Company, who had a history of fiercely resisting union activity in its plants and harassing union leaders. The company used violent and deceitful union-busting methods that the president of the company detailed in a document called the Mohawk Valley Formula. This formula, which became widely used, included warlike force and the use of the media to discredit union leaders and frame strikers as agitators who don't deserve rights. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for May 26, 1232, the Pope sends the first Inquisition team to Spain.
I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
On this day, May 26th in 1637, a coalition of English settlers with Narragansett and Mohican warriors massacred a village of Pequot people near the present-day town of Mystic, Connecticut, killing between 600 and 700 people, nearly all of whom were women, children, or elderly men. The Pequot had initially welcomed the Puritan immigrants and had established trade relations with them, but the colonists soon began to expand their hunting forays in search of furry animals whose pelts were a valued commodity to trade back in Europe. In response to this encroachment, the Pequots began to attack various settlements and forts, occasionally killing a settler or two. The Narragansett and Mohicans held a long-established rivalry with the Pequots and were easily recruited by the Puritans to make war upon them. Within a few years, all of the Pequots were nearly wiped out, with many of the survivors becoming slaves for the Puritans.
More revolutionary fervor in 1791, down with all tyrants. King Louis XVI is forced by revolutionary French assembly to relinquish its crown and state assets.
This is your radio reporter, Arturo Contreras.
On this day, May 26th in 1836, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Pinckney Resolutions, also known as the Gag Rule. The resolutions technically barred abolitionist petitions to Congress, which in practice meant that Congress could not interfere with slavery. The pro-slavery Pinckney resolutions were sparked after an abolitionist group in Washington, D.C. began showering the House of Representatives with hundreds of petitions against slavery. And yes, petitioning the government is a right guaranteed by the First Amendment, but Congress strategically avoided these abolitionist petitions, and once the new gag rule was passed, any petition dealing with slavery could legally be ignored. This gag rule, in place from 1836 to 1844, effectively prevented any discussion of slavery within the U.S. Congress. Now that's what I call model democracy.
Also in the state in 1972, Nixon's plan to break into Democratic headquarters fails at the Watergate Hotel.
On this day, May 28th in 1830, U.S. President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act into law, intending to conquer all the land east of the Mississippi River. The act provided federal funds to negotiate land exchange treaties with Native Americans, but the American government often used intimidation and physical violence to get their treaties signed. An example of the government's strategy when a treaty was resisted is the Trail of Tears, in which 15,000 Cherokee people were forced to leave their homeland at gunpoint. Between 4,000 and 8,000 Cherokee died during this 1,000-mile march to the west. In 2004, the government offered an apology to the Native American people for its ill-conceived policies.
On this day, May 28th in 1871, the famed Paris Commune was overrun by French Republican troops and was thus brought to an end. The Commune was essentially an insurrectionist mini-republic within the city of Paris, assembled by French patriots who opposed the French alliance with the newly formed German Empire in the wake of the Franco-Prussian War. The Communards, as they were called, sought to defend the aims of the French Revolution, both from foreign aggression and the threat of resurgent French monarchy. They set up barricades and armed themselves, and for nearly 2 months they ran the city as an autonomous democratic republic. The Communards adopted a cumbersome but admirably inclusive democratic process, wherein most administrative and policy decisions were made by popular plebiscites in which women were allowed to vote on an equal standing with men. The French Republican troops repeatedly attacked the Commune, and so France's first experiment with representative democracy existed only under a state of siege. After the final rout by the Republican troops on this day, as many as 20,000 Paris Commune participants were rounded up and executed.
Also on May 28, 1909, in Brooklyn, police chief orders cancellation lecture by anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman. Due to continuing harassment, quote, a demand for free speech, unquote, manifesto was signed and circulated by prominent individuals to protest the recent suppression of Emma Goldman's rights and Free Speech Society is formed. Also on this date in 1972, three strikes are out. Third Watergate break-in attempt by Nixon's agents finally succeed, but the tap placed on the Democratic chairman's phone fails to operate. On the same day, Nixon operatives attempt a second break-in to McGovern headquarters, which also fails.
Are you really saying the president can do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
This week in radical history for May 29, 1453, Constantinople, the capital of Eastern Christianity, falls to the Turks and the Byzantine Empire ends. The city would become the capital of the Ottoman Empire and is renamed Istanbul. This also marks the end of the Middle Ages.
Istanbul is Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight, high moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Even old New York was once New Amsterdam.
Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
Back to a little more serious history. In 1931 in Rome, 32-year-old anarchist Michel Giroux is executed by the fascist firing squad. Giroux was an immigrant to the United States, a committed anti-fascist. He then returned to Italy, where he'd be arrested and tried for the attempted assassination of Mussolini. There was no judge, no jury, no witnesses, and no lawyers allowed.
On this day, May 29th in 1932, thousands of World War I veterans began pouring into Washington, D.C., demanding the bonuses they had been promised. By June, the number of veterans in D.C. reached between 20 and 40,000. When the veterans disregarded orders to leave D.C., police and military troops armed with tanks, guns, and tear gas attacked their camps, leaving many injured and causing some deaths. The march inspired Congress to pass the GI Bill of Rights over 10 years later in 1944, but the bonuses still weren't accessible until 1945, even though the Great Depression left many of the veterans unemployed and homeless.
This week in radical history for May 30th, 1431 in France, 19-year-old Joan of Arc is burned at the stake. Also May 30th, 1937, police murder 10 fleeing workers, wound 30 more, and beat 55 so badly that they required hospitalization during the Memorial Day massacre at the Republican Steel Plant in South Chicago.
And also on this day, 1967, the Arab nations of Egypt and Jordan formed a mutual defense alliance against Israel. Egypt had earlier nationalized the Suez Canal, which in turn provoked an invasion by Great Britain, the United States, and Israel acting in concert. The invasion forces withdrew and left a United Nations police force in place in the Sinai Peninsula to protect the canal. Israeli expansion into Palestine increased tensions with the Arab nations, and Egypt expelled the UN troops and began to forbid Israeli ships from using the canal. Israel responded by threatening to launch an attack against Egypt, and Egypt began to build up its military presence in the Sinai. These were the conditions that led up to the so-called Six-Day War in October of that year, which began with an Israeli invasion that was immediately supported by the United States, Britain, and France.
This week in Radical History from May 31, 1891, I Sing the Body Electric, America's first great poet, Walt Whitman, lives.
On this day, May 31st, in 1889, a dam on the Conemaugh River in Pennsylvania gave way, causing a massive flood that completely destroyed the town of Johnstown, killing more than 2,200 people. The dam served no other purpose than to create the artificial Lake Conemaugh as a recreational hunting and fishing destination for members of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, which had failed to adequately maintain it. Engineers had some advance warning of the dam's imminent breach, but many residents of Johnstown were unwilling or unable to evacuate. None of the dam owners, which included steel industry magnate Andrew Carnegie, banker Andrew Mellon, and numerous other industrial tycoons, were prosecuted for the Johnstown flood. In 1921, a riot broke out in an African-American neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, during which more than 300 people were killed and 35 square blocks of the city were burned to the ground. When reports of an alleged assault on a white female teenager by a black male youth were circulated in the local white-owned newspaper, a mob began to assemble at the courthouse. The assault may never have occurred, as no police reports were made which substantiate the allegation, but a 19-year-old shoeshiner, Dick Rowland, was taken into custody by the sheriff. Meanwhile, the same newspaper that had misreported the alleged assault apparently ran an editorial calling for lynchings of black people. Groups of armed black men arrived and offered to assist the sheriff in protecting Rowland from the growing mob, but the sheriff refused their aid and the white mob attacked some of the would-be defenders, thus sparking an all-out attack on the Greenwood neighborhood. Over the next 12 hours, most of the Greenwood neighborhood was destroyed, and many of the residents who either tried to hide or defend themselves were murdered. There were even reports of small aircraft being used to drop homemade bombs on some of the houses. The next morning, Oklahoma National Guard troops arrived to suppress the riot. And speaking of illegal aerial bombing of civilians, the U.S. Congress voted today in 1973 to cut funding for the bombing of Cambodia, which had begun secretly in 1971 under the Nixon administration. Nixon advisor and noted bomb advocate Henry Kissinger appealed to the Congress to allow the bombing to continue, but public pressure prevailed and the legislators pulled the plug. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, May 31st. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Enid Quinn.
Been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, thanks to some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks for listening to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. And as always, until next week, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
A voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted.
You're
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, in discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. War with Iran. Not a day passes that we do not hear our media pundits speculate on this possible disaster. But they have good reason. President Trump is reneging on the Obama-signed nuclear treaty with Iran, so much for honoring our word on treaties, and the constant undercurrent is that we are doing this at the behest of Israel. We begin this morning with an analysis by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson that supports that argument, that Israel is driving the push to attack Iran, in a speech that was delivered in March of 2018 at a conference developed by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. We begin with his introduction to the conference.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is up next, and his bio is incredibly long, and he has a lot to talk about, so I'm going to shorten it. He is going to talk about, is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? And his last position in the government was as Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff from 2002 to 2005. And before serving at the State Department, Wilkerson served 31 years in the U.S. Army, and he retired from active service in 1997 as a colonel and has taught national security affairs in the honors program at George Washington University. And you're currently a distinguished visiting professor of government and public policy at the College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, and you're working on a book about the first George Bush administration. Welcome.
I have to identify myself with the remarks that were just made. Over some 400 students, graduate and undergraduate, and 12 years on two university campuses, and 6 years with about 1,000 students at two of the nation's most prestigious war colleges, we have determined, although it would be probably difficult to prove, and that's the reason we have covert operations, that Lyndon Johnson not only knew the gory details of the Israeli attack on USS Liberty in the eastern Mediterranean, he also knew about what was just told you. That is to say, he knew the uranium was being diverted, he knew Israel was building a bomb, and he chose not to do anything about it. That's not my subject today, although I could talk on that sort of thing forever, as I'm sure. These days, I believe one gets the best insights into Israeli security policy and perhaps even into Israeli policy writ large, which you've heard a lot about today, from the Russian emigre to Israel, a former foreign minister, and now it's defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman. Whether it's his calling Arab members of the Knesset war criminals or declaring the Jewish people should leave France, or claiming that the next military action against Hamas in Gaza will be the last, or contradicting his own military chief by denying there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, or stating categorically that the IDF will stop at nothing in order to win, reminding me a great deal of Dick Cheney, Lieberman is the living face of Bibi Netanyahu's Zionist policies. I sometimes think he would have rather remained in Russia so long as it was the Soviet Union and as so long as he were in a significant position of power there. In addition to reminding me of Cheney, he is reminiscent of, and indeed might well be a latent version of, Joseph Stalin. As an aside, it is intriguing, and I think well outside the usual conspiracy theory, to consider whether or not Lieberman has been intimated of our own President Trump might be an NKVD, GRU, KGB, FSB, you name it, plant. That is an agent of Vladimir Putin. He has more or less forged most of the 1 million Russian emigres since 1991 into a formidable political force, forming the political party that has more than once played kingmaker in the Israeli political scene. What a strategic coup for Vladimir, the master chess player in the world today, in my estimation, while everyone else plays a really lousy game of checkers. It would be quite a coup for him. Of far more concern at the moment and readily provable, unlike what I just said, Lieberman exemplifies where Israel is headed, toward a massive confrontation with the various powers arrayed against it, a confrontation that will suck America in and perhaps terminate the experiment that is Israel and do irreparable damage to the empire that America has become. Lieberman will speak in April in New York City at the annual conference of the Jerusalem Post. The title is, quote, "The New War with Iran," unquote. It is clear that he's in the forefront of promoting this war. And nowhere does my concern about such a war focus more acutely at the moment than in Syria. As President of France, Emmanuel Macron, described it recently, quote, "The current rhetoric of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel is pushing the region toward conflict with Iran," unquote. In that triad, no state is doing that more than Israel. Listen to Netanyahu in January at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem. Quote, "The greatest danger that we face of hatred for the Jewish people and the Jewish state comes from Iran. It comes from the Ayatollah regime that is fanning the flames of anti-Semitism," unquote. This anti-Semitism bit, of course, as we've heard it today, almost always a weapon of choice for Israeli politicians under stress, hurled in this case at the country whose Jewish population, by the way, the largest in the Middle East outside Turkey and Israel, lives in Iran in reasonable peace. And don't forget that these words are uttered by the man who is, as we've heard here today briefly, doing everything he can to expel dark-skinned African refugees, largely from Eritrea and the Sudan, from Israel, where most have come as legitimate refugees. President Trump's wall on the Mexican border is nothing compared to Bibi's actual policies. More recently, Bibi's performance at the Munich Security Conference bordered on the infantile and yet effective when you think about the audience to whom he's speaking, as he held off an alleged piece on an alleged Iranian drone and asked Monsieur Zarif if he recognized it. Of course, Mr. Zarif later took his occasion at the microphone to characterize Netanyahu's performance as like that of a circus clown. Pretty good characterization, as a matter of fact. But I like the comment of Lebanon's defense minister even better. It went to the point. He said that he had an Israeli drone over his head virtually 24/7. That comment put the hypocrite that Netanyahu is in the right perspective. Of late, of course, Tel Aviv is increasingly using Iran's presence in Syria, its support for President Bashar al-Assad, and its alleged drive, and I love this one, my military comrades love it too, for a Shia corridor from Tehran to Aden as the hoary beast that must not be at any cost, including, of course, American treasure and lives, as his probable cause and existential prompt for action. That Israel has in support such disparate figures as Nikki Haley at the United Nations, Jim Mattis at the Pentagon, Rex Tillerson at State, as well as the usual suspects from outside the world of warmed-over neoconservatives, is indicative of such policy. But it's not just the usual suspects from the world of neocons, about whom I know quite a bit, having experienced them in 2001 and 2 and 3. Take, for example, my South Carolinian fellow South Carolinian, Lindsey Graham, speaking 4 days ago after a breathless trip to Israel, a bipartisan trip, he called it. I don't know how anybody could use that term. And I caution, don't laugh, because Lindsey was serious, I think. But anything bipartisan with regard to Israel, call it unanimity. Call it absolute unanimity, anything but bipartisan. In fact, the proper words are probably overwhelming and an unprecedented unanimity. In fact, the only issue that does unify the United States Congress, other than mom and apple pie. But Graham had this to say, quote, "Anytime you leave a meeting where the request is ammunition, 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 that's probably not good." That's Lindsey. That's Lindsey. I know Lindsey well. "This was the most unnerving trip I've had in a while," he said breathlessly again. Graham went on to assert that, quote, when they tell you we won't help to deal with the blowback that might come from attacks on civilian targets where Hezbollah has integrated military capability, that was so striking. That was striking, end of quote. And then Senator Coons, who up until this time I've had some respect for, fairly sane and sober senator from Delaware, reported that, quote, "the tempo in terms of potential for conflict in Syria has gone up astronomically. The technologies Iran is projecting into Syria and southern Lebanon has gone up. Iran's willingness to be provocative, to push the edges of the envelope, to challenge Israel has gone up," end of quote. Coons reported this almost as breathlessly as Lindsey. "With the highest tech nation on earth in Syria, the United States of America, that is all Coons could derive from his visit. That the country that spends less than 1% of what the U.S. spends on its national security has introduced new technologies in Syria, technologies that threaten the country Israel, to whom the U.S. bounty is limitless? This is Joseph Goebbels' territory. Karl Rove is envious. The foundation for the defense of democracies as the heir to the Project for a New American Century, Bill Kristol's Iraq-bound think tank, leads that pack of wolves disguised as warmed-over neocons, lavishly funded by the likes of Paul Singer. It's even spawned the Institute for the Study of War, a fascinating Orwellian title if there ever was one. It should be the Institute for War. I've been asked, why is it that you ascribe to FDD and now the ISW such nefarious motives? I was asked this by the New York Times editorial staff when they published my op-ed on Iran a few days ago. My answer is simple, because that is precisely what FDD is attempting to do. Just as Douglas Feiss, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Office of Special Plans, did in 2002 and 2003 for Richard Bruce Cheney to lead us into war with Iraq. I've been there, done that. I don't need the tour. The salient question, though, why do you believe that America is headed for a struggle with Iran, needs an answer. Certainly, America's unquestioning support is required, as has been the case from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to the rapture-seeking Mike Pence and the tweeter and king Donald Trump. But it seems that recently, Lieberman and Netanyahu and their acolytes in this country, amongst which I put at the top Nikki Haley, have determined that it would be best if American troops also participated in the overthrow of the Tehran regime. From one point of view, I suppose this is understandable, the crassly opportunistic point of view, that is, that better to squander your own allies' blood and treasure than your own, but it's certainly not in the character that I'm used to with regard to the state of Israel, and certainly not with regard to the Israeli Defense Force. That force could handle anything Iran threw at it militarily is undeniable. Any military professional will tell you that. And that Israel's more than 200 nuclear warheads could decimate Iran is equally undeniable. So why this attempt to suck America into this conflict? I believe the answer is fairly clear once you push aside the cobwebs that surround it. The legitimacy of great power is what I call it, and that is precisely what Netanyahu and Lieberman desire. It's also what Riyadh desires, especially with the new boy king, Mohammed bin Salman. Now an erstwhile ally of Israel. In short, the IDF could defend Israel, but it could not attack Iran, not successfully anyway. And were it to do so, it would be damned internationally and thus isolated even more than it already is today, perhaps devastatingly so. But America, already damned by well more than half the world, polls show at least 4 billion people think we're the number one threat to their security in the world. Think about that for a minute. We've already done Iraq, Libya, and Syria, Afghanistan. We'd just be seen as continuing the trend. Besides, America has the military capacity, and here's the long pole in the tent, to project the power needed to unseat swiftly the regime in Tehran. Swiftly in terms of Saddam Hussein, for example, not swiftly in terms of taking care of 75 million people, each one of which in a very rugged and strategically deep terrain would want to kill every damned American in the country, along with probably half the rest of the Arabs in the area. So there's only one significant hang-up that I see with this strategy that Netanyahu and Lieberman are pushing. Embroiled in his own legal problems that just might send him to jail, as such problems would likely have sent Arik Sharon to jail had he not been in really bad shape at the end of his prime ministership, they're both headed for war. Of that, I'm convinced. They will use Iran's allegedly existential to Israel presence in Syria, which is becoming even more so from a military perspective every day. Hezbollah's accumulation of some 150,000 missiles, if we believe our intelligence agencies, the need to set Lebanon's economy back yet again, that's important. Look at what they're deliberating right now with regard to the new, very, very rich gas find in the eastern Mediterranean, with Israel claiming Section 9 and Lebanon claiming Section 9. Take that, Lebanon. We're going to bomb you. Then you'll let us have it. And that will be their excuse. And we're looking at them taking on, and this is a point that all military people understand, a country that couldn't beat Iraq in 8 years of brutal, bloody war. An Iraq that we beat in 19 days. So this is the colossal threat that they're up against. And men such as H.R. McMaster are helping them. The much-heralded author of Dereliction of Duty, great title, and a man who knows about as much about Iran as I do about the 8th planet in the 95th solar system in the 50th galaxy past our own. And here's a hope I have. Let's hope that the chess master-in-chief, old Vladimir Putin, he that ruins elections from Paris to Peoria, is smart enough, once again, not to let this happen. I fear he'll not be, and we might have the stirrings of 1914, as utterly stupid as we now know those stirrings to have been. People to whom I mention such possibilities, people who are critically analytical and normally fairly sound in their thinking, respond that, well, don't you consider that sort of dreary prognosis a little bit overdrawn? My rejoinder is usually something a bit too clever, perhaps, but along these lines, don't you think a number of people said that in the summer of 1914? They respond, but have we not learned so much since then? I'll let you be the judge of that and inform you only that in my considered view, we have learned very little, and there are the ingredients right now with Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, losing dramatically in Yemen right now, and the United States and Russia at the peak of all of this to get engaged. A very distinct possibility. I looked at this from the perspective of the political parameters. What is it that we're confronting today in this country? And this took me down an entirely different path as I tried to figure out just how this team of McMaster, Tillerson, Kelly et al., and Trump at the top of it will face this sort of decision-making process. And the only place I could find that remotely resembled where we are today in our past was the period 1850 to 1860. And so about 6 months ago, I started reading as voraciously as I could on that period. I'd done some reading, but I needed to really do a lot more. It is stunning, the similarities between that period and now, particularly in the political situation where one side of the country wouldn't talk to the other side of the country, and vice versa. And I was struck today by some of the comments that were made that resemble the comments that were made by my region, my state fired on Fort Sumter, after all, back in those days. And if that is the political situation in which this government will do its national security decision-making, then we are in deeper trouble than even the prospects of a region-wide and perhaps even bigger war in the Middle East. And the country that will have started it all, the relationship, unbalanced as it is, that will have made it possible, is Israel. And that's the danger we face.
You have been listening to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson speaking at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs conference held in Washington, D.C. Our Palestinian voice this morning is that of the activist law professor Nora Erekat, speaking at this very same conference on the topic of Israel's violations of international law. We begin with her introduction to the conference.
Our final speaker, Nora Erekat, is a noted legal scholar, human rights attorney, and activist. She is an assistant professor at George Mason University, a co-founder and editor of Jadalia Ezin, and an editorial committee member of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Prior to joining the George Mason faculty, she served as legal counsel for a House subcommittee, legal advocate for the Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, and as the national grassroots organizer and legal advocate at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, now the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Most recently, she released a pedagogical project on the Gaza Strip and Palestine, the centerpiece of which is a short multimedia documentary titled Gaza in Context, which positions Israel's wars on Gaza within a settler colonial framework. She is also the producer of the short video Black Palestinian Solidarity and is currently working on a book project tentatively titled Justice for Some, Law as Politics in the Question of Palestine. It's a great pleasure to introduce Nora Erekat.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you to all of you. I think you are very brave to come to this session, which focuses on law, which in and of itself is meant to be obscurist in order to disempower people to take their lives into their own hands, and by its very definition is indeterminate. So what we believe the law to proclaim is going to be subject to our own mediation as well as judicial interpretation. So anything on its face that the law tells us can be subject to some sort of legal controversy depending on who the lawyer is representing. So I really appreciated Dr. Tilley's presentation, but if my client were Israel, I could use the very same legal framework to come to a very different conclusion, which is why our reliance on law has to come with a great deal of skepticism and with a strategic vision. With that in mind, I want to build on what was said earlier to discuss occupation law and the way that occupation law has not failed to stem the proliferation of settlements and settlers within the West Bank and in Gaza until 2005, but instead, without occupation law, Israel could not have and could not continue to expand and entrench its settler colonial presence within the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, and frankly, throughout Mandate Palestine. So quick note on framework. Dr. Tilley walked us through apartheid and said that this would recast how we envision this to now think of it as settler colonialism. I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, project that's distinct from colonization in that the settler who travels into the colony is traveling with their sovereignty with an intent to stay. That intent to stay in the colony and to assert their sovereignty also places an imperative to remove the native. And so that there are two processes at play. There is the removal of the native with the intent to replace them with the settler and to establish a continuous, uninterrupted, temporal, and spatial presence. And this is from Patrick Wolf's Logic of Elimination, so that the Nakba and the removal of the settler, of the Palestinians, isn't an event, but becomes an ongoing Nakba, as Palestinians have referred to it, but also fits in this theoretical framework. If then we begin with settler colonization as the framework, apartheid and occupation become two legal regulatory regimes that enable and fulfill those settler colonial ambitions of removal and replacement. So Dr. Tilley discussed one approach, apartheid, I'll discuss occupation. I'm not sure how this works, but here's the map that you may be familiar with. Obviously, Israel never defined its borders. These are the 1949 armistice lines established in March that have never been declared in order to facilitate expansion. When Israel conquered the territories in 1967, 90% of Israelis polled wanted to maintain them, mostly for religious reasons, with having an affectionate relationship to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. But that religious relationship had no political legitimacy, and therefore Israel had no basis to remain and was compelled to actually withdraw. But Israel wanted the territories, wanted to get around the law, and again, as what was mentioned, how do you get through that elevator, wanted to get around the law. It couldn't annex the territories, even if it wanted to, because of the prohibition on annexation, which comes into disrepute in the late 18th century. Up until then, territorial conquest was forbidden. But it also, let's say that it didn't care about the laws we've seen in its annexation of Jerusalem and otherwise. It didn't want to annex the territory because it would have to absorb the Palestinian population, thereby disrupting a Jewish demographic majority that had been established in the aftermath of the Nakba and the removal of 800,000 Palestinian natives. So how then? And if it recognized the territory as occupied, it would have to revert the territory to its sovereign and maintain the territorial, demographic, and political status quo. So here's the problem. It wants the land, but it doesn't want the people on the land. If it annexes the land, it absorbs the population. If it doesn't annex the land and acknowledges occupation, it has to give the land back. So instead, Israel creates a new category in law known as, and declares that this occupation is sui generis, or distinct and unlike any other category, and argues that because Jordan's annexation of the West Bank in 1950 is not recognized by anyone besides Britain and Pakistan, and Egypt is only in authority of the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians don't exist as a people, that the territories belong to no sovereign. As such, occupation law is enshrined by the Hague Regulations, the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as customary law, cannot be triggered. There is a sovereign void. This is not occupation by law, but shall be an occupation by fact. What does that allow Israel to do? It allows it the legal right to have presence in the territories without the legal obligation to maintain the status quo ante until the reversion of sovereignty. What does that allow for Israel? It allows it to incrementally take the land under two legal fictions, the legal fiction of military necessity and the legal fiction of temporality. As far as military necessity is concerned, the idea is that it is taking the land in order to create military encampments and that all of the civilian presence is temporary. Obviously, that's a contradiction on its face because you don't place civilians in a military encampment, otherwise you're using your own civilians as human shields, or it is in fact permanent. That is the first legal fiction. The second legal fiction of temporality is what Meir Shamgar, the military advocate general and then chief justice for the Israeli High Court for two decades, describes as temporality. It's a temporary presence of the civilians, but it is not, which is indefinite, which is the opposite of permanent. Meaning that it is not permanent, but we do not have to declare an end to it, and that is the opposite of permanency, and therefore can be temporary. That is a legal fiction. But these legal fictions survive, because the law in and of itself, and especially international law, lacking a hierarchical adjudication system, lacking a reliable enforcement model, becomes subject to the political will of the international community and therefore can vary by application, implementation, and interpretation as it does here. The United States is central to this interpretation. And it's central to this interpretation, despite the fact that it has its sub-administrations from the Johnson administration to the present, well, not this administration, have recognized that occupation law applies as a matter of law, not fact, and Israel is actually an occupying power, but has failed to implement its own interpretation of law for two reasons. One is, in the aftermath of the 1967 war, the Johnson administration determined the value of Israel as a Cold War asset in the Middle East as it vied with the Soviet Union to fill the power vacuum left by the European colonial powers. In that struggle to fill the power vacuum, what it decided and inaugurated after 1967 was a policy of ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge over any single one of its neighbors or collection of its neighbors so that it could prevail in a military confrontation should it arise. That's policy one. Before that, the United States had maintained a stalemate policy of equally arming Israel and its allied Arab monarchical regimes. So qualitative military edge. The second policy that it inaugurates, and this is another piece of this framework of why this sui generis occupation works, is that the Johnson administration also inaugurates and helps to orchestrate the Land for Peace framework, which is enshrined in UN Security Council Resolution 242. At the time that Israel occupies these territories, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, The UN is in session and is in agreement that Israel is an occupying power and should withdraw. If, in fact, its attack on Egypt's air force, which had lain barren in the Sinai Peninsula and which was destroyed in 2 hours, if that initial attack was unprompted, then Israel has committed aggression, which is use of force that is illegal, and therefore has the legal obligation to withdraw without preconditions. If instead that was a preemptive use of force or self-defense, then Israel has the right to remain as an occupying power, but under no circumstances to assert title or territorial conquest. Why does this matter? In the drafting of the Security Council resolution, Johnson personally himself wanted to ensure that Israel can maintain the territories as consideration for exchange, in exchange with the Arab states for permanent peace as part of a contractual agreement. Johnson was senator during Eisenhower's administration when Eisenhower forced Israel, France, and the UK to withdraw from the Suez Canal. And so and Johnson thought at the time Israel should have been allowed to maintain the Egyptian territory and hold on to it until Egypt agreed to normalize its relationship with it and to establish a permanent peace. Here in 1967, the opportunity arose again, and rather than apply international law and withdrawal as a legal obligation, instead it becomes reformulated as a political equation of a quid pro quo exchange of land when you give us peace. In the negotiations, there was disagreement Israel wanted to keep it. So there was disagreement about which territories were to be withdrawn from. And the debate then raged about the terms of withdrawal, of immediacy, what would come first, withdrawal or peace. There was one other piece of the debate, which was the armistice lines as being tenuous and not being the permanent lines. The Johnson administration, as well as the UK, urged that the definite article, the, be dropped from the resolution in order to permit negotiation on the permanent borders, but never, ever to actually change the territorial integrity. And so here is one. There were five draft resolutions at the time. This is the Latin American bloc resolution. You could see in every other draft resolution, besides the one that's ultimately presented by the United Kingdom that becomes the language of 242, the definite article, the, all the territories, is included. The U.S. votes for this, by the way. It doesn't pass because there's disagreement about the sequence of withdrawal or peace. This is the final resolution. This is actually 242. You'll see that the definite article is dropped. But in the preambular text, there's the prohibition on the acquisition of territory by war. In the actual clause itself, it's stipulated that it was occupied in recent conflict. We know that legal loopholes are coming. And state after state, including France, argue that this is to be understood as allowing for minor border modifications. But Abba Iban, who represents Israel to the UN during this time and is quite exceptional in his skills, explains very forthrightly, the resolution means what it says and does not mean what it does not say. Another legalese that becomes consequential to this present day, together with Israel's own logic of what it would need to establish permanent borders, this one articulated by Deputy Prime Minister Igal Alon, who argues that defensible borders would be tantamount to this. As you could see, all of the orange is what Israel defines as what its defensible borders would look like. And what would be necessary for security purposes, there is Jerusalem is part of that plan. There is continuity between the interior of Israel as well as its border with Jordan. It controls almost the entirety of the eastern border. This is what it wanted articulated in 1967. It is achieved far more than that. It is achieved far more than that into the present. So let me just also add here that this could not be possible to the present without Palestinian participation and acquiescence, as embodied and represented through the peace process that's inaugurated in 1993. The Oslo Accords themselves, Dr. Tilley referred that we should compare them to apartheid plans. I would urge you to compare them to the 1978 Middle East peace process framework established by Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that articulates a framework of autonomy without sovereignty. And it is verbatim. A replication of that document that never envisioned a state. A state was never part of the negotiations. And this outcome is not because the law didn't work. It's because the law has worked perfectly well and very effectively that we have this outcome. How does that work? So here are the three parts. Israel is claiming that it is a sui generis occupation, therefore it has no legal obligation to apply occupation law, including the prescription on civilian settlement and captured or encapsulated by Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, also tantamount to a war crime. And under their presence, they can both take the land under military necessity and remain there under the legal fiction of temporality. Then, why can they change the borders and not maintain the 1967 border? Because under Security Council 242, the resolution doesn't specify, it says withdraw from territories, but doesn't specify from which territories. because of the lack of the definite preposition. And three, this would have totally failed as a legal argument because it does not withstand any judicial scrutiny and has been rejected by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court, by the UN Security Council, as we've seen most recently in UN Security Council 2334, as well as by multiple human rights organizations, but nevertheless remains valid as a legal argument because of the third prong, which is the U.S. provision of political immunity and support, despite its own policy imperatives, because it doesn't want to apply sanctions on Israel because that would diminish its qualitative military edge, and it doesn't want to apply international law as a matter of that would dictate the outcome because that would actually diminish Israel's negotiating hand in negotiations. And so those three parts together reinforcing create this outcome today, which has where Israel has taken the land but not taken the people and has enabled it to remove the Palestinians, to concentrate them and to dispossess them onto these plots of land. This scenario that we see in the West Bank very vividly also exists in the Gaza Strip, but even there it's a very large concentration and it too has been reduced in size the last time in 2014 by expanding the buffer zone by 40%. And if I had the map, which I do not, of Israel proper, we can see the concentration of Palestinians. Similarly, I think it was the first zone that Dr. Tilley pointed out to you, both in the Galilee region, which is the highest concentration of Palestinian citizens of Israel, or natives, essentially, as well as in the Negev. The concentration of Palestinians in the Negev is what is driving Israel today to remove those Palestinians forcefully, approximately 70,000 Palestinians, to place them into, concentrate them into urban townships, remove from their agricultural livelihoods, and to build a settlement, an Israeli settlement within Israel in their place in order to disrupt their ability to return or have a claim of that return, fully fitting within a settler colonial framework, which is what we are marching towards. And in fact, by defunding UNRWA, what we're doing is diminishing one. The idea is to make them indistinct from the rest of the Arab population so that they can be absorbed elsewhere in surrounding countries and therefore further diminish the demographic threat, so to speak, and further the idea of establishing Israel's Jewish settler sovereignty to be uncontested. That settler sovereignty to this day remains contested because of the demographic balance, and within Israel it remains an active frontier. There are other settler colonies in the world. Israel is not unique for this. The United States is a settler colony. What we see going on in the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually the removal of natives and taking away of their lands and obscuring the fact that they exist as a people and perpetuating a myth that the natives have disappeared in very similar ways that we perpetuate the myth of disappearance of Palestinians and their indistinct nationality with surrounding Arab countries. Thank you.
You have been listening to Professor of Law Nora Erekat speaking in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs annual conference held this past March. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Story that helps sell drugs, we are being telling a story that either you have a broken brain, a chemical imbalance, and need drugs for life, or you're normal, right? That's still setting up this line that divides human beings into the fit and the unfit. And you also hear all these stories that they're finding genes for this and that, right? Well, they've been finding genes for that ever since Aaron Rosenthal in 1908 said there was a normal gene and an insane gene.
Best, we know and I know, good horse mounts the
race. So, are these medical policies, or are these social policies? And are they social policies? This is the question for you all. I'm pretty sure they're not born of good science, but do they reflect this thing that we as a society are continuing to say that there's this line separating the fit from the unfit, the normal from the abnormal? I think we still are embracing that same idea, and I think history is telling us it's not a good idea.
You're listening to episode 613 of Unwelcome Guests, The Economic Disposal of the Worthless. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard Robert Whittaker, author of Mad in America, who's a keen observer of the so-called mental health of Americans, and he's going to be speaking today. We have 2 hours on the hidden history of eugenics in the USA. Eugenics, as we shall hear, was leapt upon by the barons of industry, Rockefeller and the Carnegie Foundations, as a very important idea that the public need to be informed about. And not just informed, thousands of people should be sterilized. Now, although John Taylor Gatto touches on this in The Underground History of American Education, I haven't stopped to think about the reality of a society with tens or hundreds of thousands of people who are forcibly sterilized, and a legal system that says, well, that's okay, that's constitutional, and a public that acquiesces and says, well, if it's for the good of the race, fair enough. I'm glad to be living in days in which these ideas have been discredited. I feel, in a real sense, that we have another similar phenomenon going on where the IMF, or so-called financial leaders, market makers, claim the right to decide the fate of millions or even more people based on some obscure ideas about interest rates and repayments. We'll get back to David Graeber, I dare say, next week on debt. Now, this week's presentation from Robert Whittaker shows how would-be leaders have a tendency to take whatever theories they think are going around and use them for their own political ends. Now, the lecture continues into the second hour, and it's followed by a Q&A session. Thank you to Moses Nagel for help with the audio. It's a little bit mucky in the first few minutes, but the audio quality settles down. Now, this presentation is from 2012.
Tonight we have with us Robert Whittaker. Robert is a journalist and the author of 4 books. Much of his writing is focused on psychiatry, the pharmaceutical industry, and medical histories. His first book, Mad in America, which we were just talking about, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and Enduring Mistreatment of Mentally Ill, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. His second book, The Mapmaker's Wife, A True Tale of Love, Murder and Survival in the Amazon, was named by the American Library Association as one of the best biographies of 2004. In 2008, Crown published his book, On the Lapse of Gods, The Red Summer of 1919 and the Struggle for Justice That Remade a Nation, which was awarded the Anthony J. Lucas Work in Progress Prize. His newest book Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America, won the Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism in 2010. Prior to writing these books, Robert worked as a science and medical reporter at the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York for quite a while. His journalism articles won several national awards, including a George Polk Award for medical writing and a National Association of Science Writers Award for Best Magazine Article. A series he co-wrote for the Boston Globe was named as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1998. So we were very fortunate to have Mr. Whitaker.
Thanks very much. It's really nice to be here. I wrote Mad in America in 2002, which is in that book where I wrote about the history of eugenics. So this is the first time I've been talking about this surgery for almost 10 years. So we'll see how much I can remember. Now I have my cheat note and my crib notes here. I think the big picture is this that we'll talk about. I'll talk about 45 minutes and we'll have some time for just discussion. We in the United States, of course, we have this big picture history that sort of governs our society, which is sort of this history of the chosen people. We go back to the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. And we have this sense that society was born with these sort of really profound principles of democracy, etc. And then we do have the sense that we are a people better than other people, so to speak, in our history. The eugenics history tells a different story. It's one of our darkest episodes in American history. It isn't really taught in American schools, but I think it should be taught. It's an important part of our history. It talks about how complicated our history has been, and I'll talk about how that affected care of, quote, mental people with psychiatric problems for the first half of the 20th century, and then we'll talk about whether the sort of eugenic attitudes towards the, quote, mentally ill have really disappeared. Are they still around, just hidden, that sort of thing. So that's sort of the context for this whole story. So if we go back to where eugenics arose, how this began to infect our society, it of course comes from Charles Darwin as the beginning moment. So in 1859, Charles Darwin publishes Origin of the Species. And of course, what is the story? What are the three points really that you get from Origin of the Species? One is that species evolve. Two, that evolution is driven through a struggle for the survival of the fittest, and the fit therefore pass on their genes. And three, in nature, the unfit are not allowed to, they don't get a chance to procreate. Okay, those are sort of the three principles you see in Origin of Species. Now, Charles Darwin doesn't talk about humans, he's really talking about others, but obviously the implication is that the human species evolved and could evolve in the future. It's not a static place, so to speak, or static species. So Charles Darwin's cousin, named Sir Francis Galton, he sees this, and he's going to become the father of the eugenics movement, idea as a science. Who is Sir Francis Galton? He was born in 1822 to a rich family in Birmingham, England. When in 1844 his father died, he therefore inherited a lot of money and never had to work for a living. Anyway, his cousin's book comes out, and he immediately grasps this idea. He says, if species evolve, and already we have farmers selectively breeding their livestock, right, to improve their pigs and cows and also their plants, etc. So if farmers can do that with their livestock and can do it with their plants, why can't societies do it with humans, is the idea. And so the minute you have this idea, you're going to start to think about who needs to breed and who does not need to breed, so to speak. So what does he say? Could not the race of men be similarly improved? Could not the undesirables be got rid of and the desirables multiplied? So that's his first principle. You hear that? Principle is we're going to start separating society into the desirables. We're going to help them breed. And we're going to have this other group, the undesirables, and we're not going to have them breed. That's the core principle we're going to see play out. But it starts right away with Sir Francis Galton as a key principle of eugenics. So the next thing what he does is he, in 1869, he publishes a scientific work called Hereditary Genes. And what he does is he goes around and he looks at 1,000 people. Yes, prominent English leaders, bankers, scientists, writers, etc. And he finds that those 1,000 people come from a select group of people in England, sort of the upper class. And he says, look, it's just a small group of people that have such accomplishments in our society, and many are closely related. Now, obviously, why is this? Well, he's a perfect example. He doesn't have to work for a living, right? He has a chance to, you know, explore science, etc. Obviously, what he's really seeing is how class-bound the society is. But he doesn't see it that way. He says these people have better germplasm. That's why they succeed so much. And the rest of people, they don't succeed because they're in essence inferior. And so what does he conclude? He says, this means that he's talking about how humans, if we really look at it, are decidedly unequal. Democratic ideals that men are of, quote, equal value are simply, quote, undeniably wrong and cannot last. Even the ordinary citizen, quote, is too base for the everyday work of modern civilization. So, given this thought, he immediately says, what do we as a society have to do? We have to encourage those with good germplasm to breed and those with bad germplasm not to breed. And here's what he writes. I do not see why any insolence of caste should prevent the gifted class, when they have the power, from treating their compatriots with all kindness, so long as they maintain celibacy. He's talking about the poor, etc. But if these compatriots continue to procreate children inferior in moral, intellectual, and physical qualities, it is easy to believe that the time may come when such persons would be considered as enemies to the state and to have forfeited all claims to kindness. So this is, you can see right away, we're going to distinguish between the fit and the unfit, and those who we're going to call the unfit, A, we don't want them breeding, and two, if they do breed, enemies of the state. So this is a founding principle. And then in 1883, he coins the term eugenics, and it's derived from the Greek word which means well-born, as the science, he says, that would, quote, improve the human stock by giving, quote, the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable than they otherwise would have had. And what he's saying is here, society has to support the rich and to in this Darwinian struggle for survival. We've got to give them extra advantages and help them breed. And those who are, quote, cacogenic or badly born, we have to suppress their breeding impulse. And this is the founding moment of the eugenics movement in 1883. Now, he's English, but where eugenics will first get a root in academic communities and will first have social policies enacted, it's in the United States, not in England. And why does it find such fertile soil here? Well, in the 1880s, 1890s, when these ideas are being promoted, the U.S. is changing a lot. Really, if you look at the population early on, it's a very white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group. But going in the late 1700s, of course, we have slaves and we have a black population, but it's a very WASPy population initially. And they're, of course, at the top of the heap. Starting in the 1850s and on, we get a lot of immigration. We get Jews, we get Italians, we get Irish, we get Slavs, etc. And all of a sudden, the country's becoming more Catholic, and not just Protestant, and not just, quote, old English white. So that ruling class here feels threatened by the immigrations, basically. We also have, of course, in the 1880s, the freedmen. So that we, of course, we're at the Civil War. We've got 4.5 million blacks that have been freed. So the country seems to be changing rapidly. So it is picked up, and in the first sort of eugenic tract you see published in the United States is published in 1891 by a feminist, an American feminist named Virginia Woodhull. She publishes a book called The Rapid Multiplication of the Unfit. She writes, the best minds of the day agree that, quote, imbeciles, criminals, paupers, and the otherwise unfit must not be bred. For that to occur, she notes, the unfit have to be prohibited from marrying, segregated into asylums, and forcibly sterilized. So as early as 1891, she's setting out a social agenda for sort of preventing the unfit from breeding. Now what will then happen is eugenics will begin to take hold and be accepted as a legitimate science over the next 20, 30 years. And we'll see how it happens that it becomes accepted as a science. The first step, and by the way, the funding for the development of this science comes from the industrial titans of America at the time. It comes from Andrew Carnegie. It comes from John D. Rockefeller Jr. And in particular, it also comes from a Mary Harriman, who's the widow of a railroad magnate, Edward Harriman. So the founding moment is 1904. Andrew Carnegie provides funds to a man named Charles Davenport to establish in Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island, quote, the name of the group is going to be the Center for the Study of Human Evolution. And again, it's to be a eugenics center. Now, who is Charles Davenport? He is of WASP heritage. He's Harvard educated. Now, remember, it's 1904, and he would like to boast that his people have been in America for 300 years. Not sure how they've been here for 300 years, but that's what he would boast. So what is the first thing that Charles Davenport begins to say? Well, he begins to say that human traits are passed down in the same way that eye color is. So we get in the 18, I forget exactly when, Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk who says that certain characteristics come in gene pairs. Let's say with his pea plants. So you have a gene, let's say, for a tall pea plant, a gene for a short pea plant. If the a tall gene is the dominant gene and you have a tall and short gene, the plant is tall. If you have two short genes, then the plant is short. Okay, that's this old Mendelian genetics. And he says human behaviors, he makes the claim, are handed down in the same way, in these sort of simple gene pairs. So he says, for example, you have gene pairs for nomadism, shiftlessness, insincerity. And again, these are gene pairs. And immigrants from Southern Europe, he says, inherited genes that made them, quote, more given to crimes of larceny, kidnapping, assault, murder, rape, and sex immorality. Jews inherited genes for thieving and prostitution. So again, basically, you would see these different immigrant groups said to have certain behavioral characteristics, and it's genetic in kind. But what are we starting to do here? We're also starting to rank people by fit and unfit. And so who's going to be at the bottom of this list? Well, it's going to be blacks, it's going to be the freedmen, and at the very bottom is going to be the insane. But that's what we're going to start doing. We're going to start ranking people in this way. Now, going forward, in 1910, at Cold Harbor, they established the Eugenics Record Office. The purpose of the Eugenics Record Office was to go out into American society and start, in the manner of a census, figuring out who are the, quote, cacogenic, the unfit in American society. So they trained, I think it was 258 field workers who then went out into prisons. They went out into asylums. And they just went out into communities and tried to figure out what percent of the population have genes unfit to be passed on. And this effort was again funded by Mary Harriman. And in 4 years, yes, they had made a conclusion, and they set out their sterilization agenda. They concluded, and the group that concluded this, that was part of the Cold Spring Harbor group, the Eugenics Record Office, the group was named the Committee to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means of Cutting Off the Defective Germplasm in the American Population. And they concluded that 10% of the American population needed to be sterilized. This is in 1914. Now, just to give you an idea, we tend to think that eugenics wasn't popular with the American people. As we go forward, we're going to see the majority of Americans believed in eugenic policies. But here's what Teddy Roosevelt, the great populist, said in response to this report that 10% of Americans needed to be sterilized. He says, and this is what he writes to the committee that put forth this. He says, at present, there is no check to the fecundity of those who are subnormal. So he's embracing this idea that 10% need to be sterilized. Now, going forward, what happens? By 1914, when this report is issued, there are 44 colleges in America that are now teaching eugenics in their curriculums. In the same way they might teach physics, they might teach mathematics, they'll teach eugenics in their science department. These classes are particularly pronounced at the Ivy Leagues, Harvard, Cornell, Brown, etc. Why? Because they're bastions, of course, of WASP privilege at this time. So they're really, this is, it's going to be an Ivy League nurtured science. MIT does it as well. They also begin to have the American Genetics Association starts a journal called the Journal of Heredity. And now the scholars begin publishing research articles on this. They talk about the birth rates of the unfit and how they have high birth rates. You'll see articles lamenting how WASP are not procreating nearly as fast as the unfit. And there's even articles about how the daughters of, the pilgrims aren't, the American Revolution are particularly bad at procreating. And you'll see things like this. Here's an article that likens immigrants to a bacterial invasion. There's another article titled The Menace of the Half-Man, in which the writer concludes that if the country could get rid of its defectives, then, quote, human misery in a well-ordered country like America will be more than cut in half. And just to, by 1924, more than 9,000 papers on eugenics had been published in academic journals. 9,000 papers. So again, there's a lot of people researching and writing on this. Finally, also, the Eugenics Research Association, they had their own research association, they boasted in 1924 that 119 of 383 members were fellows of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the nation's most prestigious scientific group. Point is, these are mainstream scientists in many ways that are pushing this agenda. So we get a seed planted in the 1880s, right? We see Virginia Woodhull talk about this. Then we see funding by the industrial titans for the Eugenics Record Office at Cold Spring Harbor. Then we see it taken up as science. So what happens in the 1920s? We now have to sell eugenics to the population as a whole. This is the next step. Now, this begins really with the... In 1921, I think, is the founding moment of really selling it to the population. And at that point, at that time in New York City, at the American Museum of Natural History, there's the Second International Congress on Eugenics, and this meeting is funded in part by the Carnegie Institution and the Rockefeller Foundation. Here's how the conference was kicked off by the museum president, Henry Fairfield Osborne. He says, "It is time for science, quote, to enlighten government in the preventing of the spread and multiplication of worthless members of our society." So that's the comment that is at the American Museum, the Natural Museum of History. Now, this conference lasted for 3 days. People from MIT, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Princeton, Cornell, etc., gave presentations of their papers. And again, it was about the rapid multiplication of the unfit and the lack of multiplication of the very fit. And here's some of the talks. They gave talks on the Jewish problem, quote, the dangers of Negro-white intermixture, and so forth. Now, this sounds extreme, right? It sounds crazy. Do you know what happened to the exhibits at that conference, where they were then sent for the next 3 months? To the American Capitol. So they went to the American Capitol and are displayed there for 3 months. My point of this is, if they go to the American Capitol, this is not seen as crazy stuff, right? This is seen as mainstream science. Now, after that meeting, here's what the New York Times editorialized after this meeting at the Natural Museum of History. They write this: "Civilization, as now organized, does not leave nature as fresh as she has been in the past to procure the survival of the fit. Modern philanthropy, working hand in hand with modern medical science, is preserving many strains which in all preceding ages would have been inexorably eliminated, strains of human beings. While life has become easier in the lower ranges, it has become more difficult for the well-born and the educated, who pay for modern philanthropy and an ever-lessening ability to afford children of their own." This is why they're not procreating. They're taking so much time caring for the unfit. "There is a very serious question whether the 20th century will be able to maintain and pass onward the infinitely intricate and specialized structure of civilization created by the 19th century." Again, this is a New York Times editorial saying that this has merit. Now, in the wake of that conference, the organizers of that conference, Charles Davenport and other mainstream eugenicists, said, "We need to form a national eugenics society, an American eugenics society." And so they now said this was on our drawing board. And as a first step, they said, "We're going to recruit 99 famous or well-known scientists to be an advisory council." And they send out a letter to the best scientists of the country. And in this letter, you can see, they warn of, quote, racial deterioration and the need to, quote, to resist the, quote, complete destruction of the white race. This is how they're recruiting scientists. And they said, if we adopt eugenics policies, quote, our burden of taxes can be reduced by decreasing the number of degenerates, delinquents, and defectives supported in public institutions. So they recruit an advisory council. And who is this advisory council? They are an elite group. From 1923 to 1935, more than half were graduates of Ivy League universities. 9 college presidents served on the council. They also had people serving on the council who were from leaders of the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Neurological Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So again, it's mainstream scientists. Now finally in 1926, 5 years after that conference, the American Eugenics Society is officially formed. It's funded in part by John D. Rockefeller and George Eastman of Eastman Kodak fame. It grows into a national organization with chapters in 28 states. What is the purpose of the American Eugenics Society? It is now to educate the public, to put out education materials about how eugenics is a science and basically how we have to have the fit breed and the unfit not breed. And remember, at the core of this is a sterilization strategy, that we're going to sterilize the unfit and keep them from breeding. So what did they do? One of the things they did is they developed traveling exhibits. And by the way, I have some of the, I didn't have slides here. If you want to see some of the pictures of this, you can go to a website that I have, robertwhitaker.org, and you just click on the book Mad in America, and you'll see some of these eugenic exhibits on there, some slides, etc. So one of the exhibits they went to, you know, schools and county fairs was called Some People Are Born to Be a Burden on the Rest. And what it had was a thing with lights that flashed. And like every 15 seconds, a light would flash, and that meant that society was spending so much money on the unfit. And then every 30 seconds, a light would flash, and it said another degenerate has now been born. I think the actual word is defective, excuse me. And then finally, there was one light over here that hardly ever blinked. After 7.5 minutes, it would finally blink. And that was a sign that somewhere in the United States, a high-grade person had finally been born. So this went, to exhibits, etc. Another exhibit that they would have as part of their traveling exhibits was to explain that certain characteristics were inherited in the same way as eye color was, or, you know, plant size, etc. So they would have these things, you know, showing eye color. If you had, like blue and brown is the dominant. And, you know, the whole thing about if you get one gene for blue, one for brown, you're brown-eyed, and you need two for blue. Well, basically, they had a thing saying the same thing about all sorts of human characteristics. And we'll talk about mental illness. But basically, one of the things they had is you could either have an insane gene or a normal gene. If you had both, you were normal, but you were a carrier. But if you got two insane genes, then you were insane. So it was a simple Mendelian gene thing that was handed down. By the way, well, this is a bit of a side. At these, if you could go back to the fairs at this time, so these things would come and they would have this traveling exhibit about how some people are born to be a burden on the rest. They would also have fitter family contests. So you know how in county fairs they will have the best pig and the best cow and et cetera, and you compete to have the best pumpkin? Well, families would also bring their family histories and compete in the family fairs to be named the fittest family. And at the end of the fair, they would actually have parades sometimes where they would have the fittest stock, and they would have the pigs and the cows, and then the fittest family would be riding in a car. And there are pictures of that, and the cars would often call this the state's best crop of the family that was the fittest family. What else did the American Eugenics Society do? They tried to recruit the clergy to give a eugenics message. And they would award ministers and all who gave the best eugenics sermon cash prizes for giving this message that we are not born equal. And here's, for example, in 1928, the winner was a Reverend William Mason. And he won the top prize that year by telling his congregation, quote, that modern science had proven that all men are created unequal. And he says, trying to lift up the unfit with education and social programs is, quote, like attempting to grow better alfalfa with dandelion seed. Can't do it. He explained, we may raise a pig in the parlor, but he remains a pig. And this won the best sermon of the year. They also put out a pamphlet called Tomorrow's Children. It was 137 pages. This urged Americans to think of the American Eugenics Society as, quote, a society for the control of social cancer, with sterilization the way to do so. The pamphlet said, crime and dependency keep on increasing because new defectives are born, just as new cancer cells remorselessly penetrate into sound tissue. So you can see what happened over this time. We get Darwin, then we get Sir Francis Galton with saying that there's this new science out there, eugenics, that's going to help human societies evolve. Very simple idea. You got to have the, quote, fit breed and the unfit not breed. You can see how contrary that is to basically what we believe are American principles, all men are created equal. We then get it sort of nurtured by rich people in this country as a science. And then by the 20s and 30s, there's this effort to convince the American population this is a good science. And so that's what goes on. So now let's see what I'll do is I'll talk about how these eugenic ideas affected the mentally, quote, you know, those diagnosed as mentally ill, and a little bit as how it affected, African-Americans, blacks as well. Okay? And then we'll go forward from there. So we talked about Mendelian characteristics. Davenport, in 1904, when he goes there to the Cold Spring Harbor and has the Society for the Study of Evolution, etc., he commissions a man named Aaron Rosenhoff, who's at King's Hospital, I think, here in Brooklyn, New York, etc., to do a study of the insane. And it's Aaron Rosenhoff that indeed finally concludes that there's an insane gene and a normal gene. And the way he does this is this science. He looks at 72 hospitalized patients, and he looks at the offspring of 1,097 relatives of these 72 hospitalized patients. Now, initially, he finds that only about, I think it's like, it's just a small number seem to be insane. And it doesn't fit his story about a simple Mendelian gene. So what does he do? He goes and looks at these relatives, and he starts saying, well, you're a little bit agitated. You count as mentally ill. And he just expands the boundaries. You've been sad. You're mentally ill. Until he gets a number of the 1,097, he concludes that 351 are mentally ill. It's right on the number if you believe in Mendelian genetics. So he comes out. He says this. Now, this gets published in textbooks, that this is the latest science that has been found, even though there were some people who said, this is the most ludicrous thing we've ever heard in our life. But here's the key thing. See how specific this does when you have Mendelian things? You're either normal or you're abnormal. We're going to say that there's this dividing line between people. It's not that you can have some psychiatric distress. It's who you are. Okay, you see that? And the New York Times editorialized, partly as a result of this understanding, it is certain that the marriage of two mental defectives ought to be prohibited because if they're carriers of a single gene, they will pass on that defective gene. All right, now how about social policy towards... What's that? That was in 1923, at this time this whole idea of enacting social policy. So what are the social policies that were enacted towards the mentally ill? Well, the first thing is they're going to prevent the, quote, the insane from marrying. They're going to establish laws. Now, the first state to establish such a law was Connecticut in 1896, 5 years after Virginia Woodhull did that. And by 1933, there was no state left in the country where the insane could legally marry. So how did this work? You went to your clerk, asked for your marriage license, and there was a little thing you had to say, are you insane? If you said you were insane, you weren't allowed to marry. But what the eugenicists noticed is very few people checked on the I am insane box. As the eugenicists complained, they are biased in favor of themselves. So, what did they have to do? The marriage laws weren't working. They had to segregate the, quote, mad, the insane, in asylums. So now if we think of mental hospitals, the old asylums. Now, if you go back to the original meaning of the word asylum, it's actually a nice meaning. It's like a refuge from sort of the difficulties of life. It's an asylum for that. You go there, you get nurtured back to health, etc., and then you come back. But now what we're going to do is the idea is we will lock up the defectives and we will keep them there through their breeding years. And so, for example, you can say, hear this comment from eugenicists in 1914. It is coming, I think, to be generally conceded that permanent segregation, at least during the period of reproductive capacity, is the preferred solution. Okay, we're going to put them away and we're going to prevent them from breeding. Now, you can see that it is during this eugenics era that we get the arise of the population state mental hospitals. In 1880, there were 31,000 people in the United States in state and county mental hospitals, basically state mental hospitals. And if you look at that number, many of them, in fact, are people that we would say have Alzheimer's today. Okay, it's basically they're serving as nursing homes often. It's end-stage dementia, and it's also related to syphilis. Syphilis, if you untreated syphilis, which was unsyphilis this time, it ends up in dementia, lots of bizarre things. So a lot of people here are there ill with neurological disorders. 31,000. But now we're going to say we're going to lock up the mentally ill. And by 1940, 60 years later, we had 419,000 patients in state hospitals. So we went from 31,000 to 419. You can also look at what was happening to first episode patients. Prior to 1880, those that were just coming in for first episode of psychosis, they generally got released. They were there for 12 months, 18 months. Now, once we get the eugenics era, they just aren't released anymore. You start being people going in at younger ages, and they just stay there. And you can see also, there's a great book called The Lives They Left Behind. Have any of you heard this book? It's a book in which they went, a state hospital was closed, and people left behind basically suitcases that were filled with their notes, their personal items, etc. So researchers went into those suitcases and they put back together a picture of the lives of people who were getting hospitalized in 1910, 1920, 1930, etc. And I'm telling you, it was immigrants acting differently, that sort of thing. You didn't have to be too crazy to be locked up in a hospital and just kept there. So anyway, that's what they've done there. So, and because of this, by the end of 1920s, you'll see in the Journal of Heredity, eugenicists saying this, segregation of the insane is now fairly complete. So you saw it as a social policy. But now what's a more permanent solution? It's sterilization, right? If we sterilize them, then they can't pass on their bad genes. In 1914, remember, we need to sterilize 10% of the American population. That's the idea. Well, the first state to pass a compulsory sterilization law was Indiana in 1907. And over the next 20 years, 30 state legislatures passed such laws. Now, initially, however, a lot of the laws were vetoed by governors, and there was a lot of opposition to these forced sterilization laws. Who did the opposition come from? Catholics, Jews, anyone who wasn't a WASP, basically, right? So this made it, really, the society was quite uneasy about this, and there really weren't many sterilizations done initially except in California. For whatever reason, it did start to happen more there. Then in 1920, so the big question is this constitutional? Does the state have a right to forcibly sterilize people? And it comes up before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1927 in a case called Buck versus Bell. And by an 8-1 vote, the United States Supreme Court says it is constitutional. States have the right to forcibly sterilize people. Here's what they wrote. We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. So that's what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled by 8-1 in 1927. And after this, forced sterilizations in the United States do take off. And in the 1930s, we're sterilizing about 2,200 people per year, adults in this country. By the end of World War II, 45,000 people had been sterilized, and about half of those were people in the state hospitals, okay, confined populations. Now, sterilization does not completely end in 1945, but it tapers off, and of course the reason it tapers off is the horrors of Nazi Germany come out, and that's clearly a eugenics policy. What would be the final solution? Kill them, right? if we just killed the unfit. Now, generally, there wasn't much discussion of this, but it was talked about in certain corners. As early as 1911, Charles Davenport, remember, he's the Harvard-educated person who was the first given funds to establish the eugenics office in Cold Spring Harbor. He wrote this in a book. He says that if a society has to choose between allowing the unfit to procreate or killing them, the latter is the preferable option. So here at this scientific thing, they're saying this is a possibility. In 1916, Madison Grant, who was a wealthy New York attorney and one of the founders eventually of the American Eugenics Society, wrote a book called The Passing of the Great Race, and he says this: the laws of nature require the obliteration of the unfit, and human life is valuable only when it is of use to the community or race. So he's setting up the possibility that maybe we need to kill people. 1916, excuse me. Now here I found something in the New York Times to say that this idea was not totally beyond the pale. So in 1921, Connecticut legislators began debating a law for euthanasia of the mentally ill, the hopelessly mentally ill. And they had the legislators tour an insane asylum, and they were given a tour of one person who was manacled to the wall, and the New York Times reported on it in this way. Here's what the law was due. Here's what the New York said. Connecticut legislators are contemplating passing a law, quote, that would provide that persons found to be hopelessly insane after observation and examination of experts should be put to death as mercifully as possible, perhaps by poison. You can read the headline. They talk about the legislators going, seeing this man who's presented them, and the headline is exhibited as case for merciful extinction. All I'm saying is, this is in a paper, as if this is something to be discussed. Now, after this, remember what's happening at this time, okay? This is the time that the American Eugenics Society is trying to educate people that certain people are social cancers, etc. And now we get discussion of human beings with language over the next 15 years by eugenicists that is just astonishing. Here's how you'll see the unfit referred to in various eugenic publications. You can hear them described as social wastage, malignant biological growths, poisonous slime. Those are some of the terms given. Then in the 1930s, Harvard's Ernest Houghton, I think he's a professor of anthropology, writes, the unfit, quote, are specimens of humanity who really ought to be exterminated. This is a Harvard professor. Finally, in 1935, Alexis Carrel, he's a Nobel Prize-winning physician at Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research on the east side here. He writes a book that is reviewed by the New York Times and other mainstream publications called Man the Unknown. And he writes this: gigantic sums are now required to maintain prisons and insane asylums and protect the public against gangsters and lunatics. Why do we preserve these useless and harmful beings? The abnormal prevent the development of the normal. This fact must be squarely faced. Why should society not dispose of the criminals and insane in a more economical manner? He goes on and he says, at least any insane person who commits a crime, he concludes, should be humanely and economically disposed of in small euthanasic institutions supplied with proper gases. So that's in 1935. Now we know where this is going to happen, but now let's go back. In 1925, Adolf Hitler writes his book, Mein Kampf, right? And he basically says eugenics is the public health approach that will restore Germany to its greatness. And you know what is happening here. We have World War I, Germany loses a lot of men, and it's also sort of impoverished. Germany wants to rebuild, and Adolf Hitler is saying in Mein Kampf, it's eugenics that will bring us back to a strong nation. Now, the very year he writes that tract, Americans, most notably the Rocker Foundation, give money to Germany to found a eugenics institute in Munich. This very same year it's written. So they give $2.5 million to establish the Psychiatric Institute in Munich, which becomes Germany's leading center for eugenic research. So German eugenics policies will be funded by us. So they gave them money to found this institute that will pursue eugenic policies in Nazi Germany. That's 1925 it gets established. Now Hitler comes to power in 1933, and one of the first things they want to do, Hitler, since he has a eugenics agenda, is to start sterilizing the mentally ill. Okay, and they want to pass a law. So what they do is they come to the United States, since we've been doing it, they send their scientists, and particularly they go to California to look at how we sterilize people here. You know, they're going to learn from us. And so, in fact, they do so. They go back, and actually Germany, when it sets up its sterilization program, believe that they're doing it in a much more, what's the word for it? Careful way, legal way. They set up a due process mechanism. The mentally ill will be hauled off to heredity courts. They will be deemed defective, and they'll be sterilized. The point is, it's a legal process. It's not just an ad hoc process. Now, when they pass this comprehensive sterilization bill, here's what American eugenicists say. They note with pride, this law was formulated only after careful study of the California experiments. Also, when Nazi Germany passes its comprehensive sterilization bill, it is applauded by the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Public Health Association, and the New York Times. The New York Times, talking about Germany's new law, cites it as an example of a progressive modern public health system. Here's what the New York Times writes. Germany is, quote, just following the path of, quote, other civilized nations, most notably the United States, where, quote, some 15,000 unfortunates have been harmlessly and humanely operated upon to prevent them from propagating their own kind. That's New York Times responding to Germany passing its sterilization law. Now, once Germany does this, they get ahead of the United States. They start sterilizing quite a few. Over the next 6 years, they sterilize 375,000 people. And as this happens, you will see some American eugenicists complaining that Germany is now beating us at our own game, that's a quote, and thereby making herself a stronger nation. So they sterilize 375,000 people. And then in January of 1940, they begin, Germany I'm talking about, killing the mentally ill. And this actually is the precursor, of course, to the Holocaust and the killing of Jews, etc. So why do they start killing the mentally ill in January of 1940? And by the way, psychiatrists are involved in this, German psychiatrists. Well, Germany invades Poland in September 1939, right? They now need the food for soldiers and all. And you can see literally, basically, these mentally ill are useless eaters, and we now need to start killing them. So they begin a killing process with proper gases, just as Alexis Carroll had said might be good, in January 1940. And over the course of the next 18 months, they kill about 70,000 mentally ill patients. At that point, these small facilities for gassing people are dismantled. They're sent to the east of Germany, and there they're rebuilt for, you know, to start killing the Jews, etc. But the Holocaust begins with the mentally ill. And you can see why. They're seen as the most unfit in society, the most useless eaters. And Germany, even, you see researchers, as they're killing mentally ill, they'll even calculate how much bread is being saved, and that sort of thing. Do you see how the Holocaust is the sort of end result of a long line of thinking? It's a long line of thinking that begins with some people are unfit and enemies of the state. It goes back to that very first thing by Sir Francis Galton. And then if you want to trace the path that leads to the Holocaust, I think you do have to say it comes to the United States, the seed of eugenics. It gets nurtured as a science here. It gets promoted to the United States, the population here. It's titans of American industry that funded here and then helped fund it in Germany as well. The point is there's a logic here in which it was developed under the cover of science. That's really the tragedy here. It was seen as a public health initiative, and it goes to this horrible end. Now, of course, we in the United States did not start killing our mentally ill. However, if you read in what happens to mental hospitals in the 1930s and 1940s, you will see the amount spent on mental hospitals drops and drops and drops. And you can say, okay, it's the depression, states are, you know, they're running out of money. That's true. But you can see how much is being spent on prisoners and how much is being spent on the mentally ill mental hospitals, and much more is being spent on prisoners. Okay, so there's in essence a designation going there. The mentally ill are the most worthless. Because of this, you see, the facilities really fall into disrepair. And at the end of World War II, a journalist by the name of Albert Deutsch, first in an essay in Life magazine and then in a book called The Shame of the States, he goes around with a photographer and he just documents what it's like in the state mental hospitals in this country. He takes pictures too. And in the photos, you'll see people sitting around naked in some cases. You'll see basically, places are deteriorated, sometimes feces just on the floor, not being picked up, etc. And here's what he writes. And Byberry, by the way, is a mental hospital in Philly, I think. As I passed through some of Byberry's wards, I was reminded of the Nazi concentration camps at Belsen and Buchenwald. I entered buildings swarming with naked humans, herded like cattle and treated with less concern, pervaded by a fetid odor so heavy, so nauseating, that the stench seemed to have almost a physical existence of its own. I saw hundreds of patients living under leaking roofs, surrounded by moldy, decaying walls and sprawling on rotting floors for want of seats or benches. All I'm saying is, if you go to the mental hospitals, the shame of the states here, okay, the country does have a lot of financial pressures. But one of the reasons the state hospitals fall into such disrepair is because we have devalued these people as unfit, okay, and that they're really a burden on society. So that's the mainstream story of eugenics as it plays out from around, well, really, 1859, Darwin is to 1945, okay? What happens, of course, is after 1945 is eugenics becomes a shamed science. We associate it with Nazi Germany, and we really don't want to look at how the U.S. in any way was involved with it and nurtured it. I want to do a couple more things here. So we have this sense of the mentally ill being prevented from marrying, segregated in asylums, sterilized, and also said to be poisonous slime, etc., etc. What sort of medical treatments are brought into the mental hospitals while we have this conception of the mentally ill as essentially worthless human beings? Well, first of all, if you read the medical texts, sterilization is now promoted as something helpful for the mentally ill. And because think if you're a doctor, right? If you're a doctor, whatever you do, you need to think of it as helpful for the person. You just have to. So what doctors will start saying is, by sterilizing these people, we remove from them the burden of their being anxious that they might one day have children. So it's sort of an anti-anxiety treatment. But what happens in the 1930s? We get a group of therapies that were even dubbed brain-damaging therapies at the time. One was metrazole convulsive therapy. Metrazole is a poison. It would cause people to have these extraordinary seizures. People would break their backs. They would break other bones. They would break their teeth sometimes. And what happened was a couple of things. One, of course, in terms of helping behavior, people would do anything not to have metrazole convulsive therapy. And so just the fear of it was seen as helpful. But also it did cause brain damage. Okay, and then when people came out of this convulsive therapy, they would be sort of like children. They would be needy. They would also be stunned, etc. So we had a therapy. So instead of ranting and whatever with their wild thoughts, they would come out of these convulsive therapies and be more childlike, needy, quiet, that sort of thing. Okay? And by the way, you wouldn't just get one metrazole treatment. You'd get multiple treatments. Another one of these brain-damaging therapies introduced at the same time was insulin. Oh, by the way, one small thing. The rationale for metrazole convulsive theory was that by causing seizures were seen to be antithetical to schizophrenia. As an antidote to schizophrenia, the idea was that seizures would somehow drive the schizophrenia out. That was the idea. Another therapy at this time was called insulin coma therapy. So they would give people shots of insulin. Of course, that would withdraw so much sugar from the body, they would go into a hypoglycemic coma. And then when they would come out of that, what would happen? The patients, again, would be sort of childish, helpless, quieter, that sort of thing. And again, though, to make it stick, you'd have to give them multiple insulin comas. At autopsy, they would show that there were lesions in the brain associated with insulin coma, etc. Then finally, we get electroshock therapy. Electroshock actually is initially developed as a way, as a replacement for metrazole convulsive therapy, as a way to more reliably induce seizures. Again, they would give multiple rounds of ECT. And again, someone coined these brain damaging therapeutics. And here is the important thing. I'm going to read this sentence. Given that the mentally ill were seen as having not really any worth, any intrinsic worth, the idea was that lowering them to a childlike state, a less intelligent state, was okay. Okay, because they're going to be less bothersome, and plus they were not seen as having value as who they were. So you will read at the time, here's from a famous psychiatrist at the time, Abraham Myerson. I think it may be true that these people have, for the time being at any rate, more intelligence than they can handle, and the reduction of intelligence is an important part of the curative process. I say this without cynicism. The fact is that some of the very best cures that one gets are in those individuals whom one reduces almost to amentia. Amentia is another word for simple-mindedness. Okay, so you can see in this there is a transformation of being happening, sort of a lowered intelligence, but that is seen as good because it knocks out these delusions, these thoughts, etc., and they're now behave more childlike and less aggressive. The question, I think, is this. Does that happen if we do not have eugenic ideas of the mentally ill? In other words, unless we devalue who they are. Now, it's at this time that frontal lobotomy comes into asylum medicine. What is frontal lobotomy? And it's invented by a Portuguese surgeon named Egas Moniz. Imagine I have two brains. I have a human brain and an ape brain. They will look virtually the same except for one thing. In the human brain, the frontal lobes will protrude. Okay, so this is seen as the part of the brain that makes us human. So in frontal lobotomy, the way it's done initially, they would put in basically a scalpel on this side and this side. So imagine scalpels going in on each side. And then they would just say here, and then they would just run the scalpel up and down. So they would cut off the front of the lobes. Now initially what they would do is they'd just cut off a little sliver of the frontal lobes. And if that did not produce the desired change in being, they'd do it again and they'd cut off more of the frontal lobes and they would just keep retreating until they got more, you know, enough of the frontal lobes. The neurologist that really became the Pied Piper of frontal lobotomy in this country was Walter Freeman. He came from he was a neurologist at both Georgetown Medical School and George Washington Medical School in D.C. And he developed a new technique for doing prefrontal lobotomies very fast. He developed something called transorbital lobotomy. What he would do is he would lie someone flat on a bed or a cot or something, and then with a hammer, he would have ice picks. Imagine I'm here, and he would just drive the ice picks up into the brain through the eyes. And so he became able to scramble the frontal lobes in about 15 minutes. And he would go around every summer with his station wagon, and he would pull into a state asylum, a state mental hospital, and the superintendent would line up 15, 20 people who were candidates for frontal lobotomy, and he would do 20 operations in the course of a morning. And he would even do it, in order to make them faster, he would drive the ice picks into each eye and then pull them up at the same time, and this way he could do it faster and faster. Now, here is what the master of frontal lobotomy said this surgery did. He, the patient, is freed from anxiety and from feelings of inferiority. He loses interest in himself, both as to his body and as to his relationship with his environment, no longer caring whether his heart beats or his stomach churns, or whether his remarks embarrass his associates. His interests turn outward, and obsessive thinking is abolished. There is something childlike in the cheerful and unselfconscious behavior of the operated patient. You see how they say they're unselfconscious anymore? The reason is it's really the frontal lobes that give us self-consciousness. This is the part of the brain that allows us to sort of think about, you know, step outside and see who we are. So you take that away, and that's basically what he's talking about here. Now, in the 1940s, they did assessments of the safety and efficacy of frontal lobotomy. And the first such study of around, I think it was around 500 operations, concluded that 84% were improved or recovered, and only 1% had worsened. Okay, again, this is seen as a positive change in gain. Here's what the researcher concluded. It can be stated categorically that if this procedure is ineffectual in helping the patient, it will do no harm. The patient may not be improved, but he will not be made worse. Now, in 1949, Egas Moniz won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for inventing surgical robotics. And you can read in the New York Times and other mainstream publications how researchers, scientists, had come to know the inner workings of the brain like a master watchman, knowing the inner workings of a complicated watch, and had learned how to pluck madness from the brain without harming the rest of the brain. This idea took hold, and at one point they even began recommending that, say, women, and it was women that this was given to, women at college who were anxious could be candidates for frontal lobotomy, and they could come in for a weekend lobotomy, and they were advised to bring dark glasses, and then you could go home the same day. You would have the frontal lobe scrambled, and then you would no longer be anxious. I don't know the numbers, but there were some women who, were in essence, were lobotomized just for anxiety as they went to college. Eventually, it was also said to be okay for kids, and there were some even, I think the earliest that I saw lobotomized was a four-year-old. So, again, how does lobotomy take hold, and how does it win the Nobel Prize in Medicine? It only happens within a context where you devalue who the people were before the surgery. And basically, you have people saying that the self-consciousness, and you'll even hear things, people who would worry about how history might have unfolded if the indigenous people of America had won. Those sort of inventive people no longer worried about such thoughts. You hear that as seen as a good outcome. I'm going to go real briefly now to, you know, how eugenics played out for African Americans, and then we'll go to this thing about do we see eugenics today, say, in the treatments of domestic violence. With African Americans, it's a little bit more complicated, basically because the denigration of blacks started much earlier, before the eugenics. It really happens in the slave era, of course. You have Southern physicians saying that the blacks, in essence, are a separate species. They have distinct pulmonary things, heart systems, etc. You'll see claims that really, if we rank species, we have the apes, we have the blacks, and then we have whites. The idea was that the black skull also closed early at age 13, and therefore they were incapable of higher intellectual functions. So this begins to take hold in prior to the Civil War. There's also a famous Swiss biologist at Harvard University, Swiss-born, named Louis Agassiz. He's so well-known. I'm from Cambridge, where Harvard University is. Up until recently, there was an Agassiz school. Well, Louis Agassiz in the 1800s taught his students that blacks were a separate species. So this was being taught at Harvard University. We get the freeing of the slaves at the end of the Civil War. We have about 12 years of Reconstruction, where they're giving voting privileges, etc. Now what happens, of course, is the South wants to set up a Jim Crow society where we're going to basically find reasons to segregate blacks, deny them voting rights, etc., where you can see how the eugenics ideas fit into that social policy. I don't think it's totally... it's not just an accident. The Jim Crow laws start happening in the 1890s. That's when they come in. At the same time, these eugenic ideas are being promoted. And so, as these ideas come in, here's what you'll read at. Here's the sort of things you'll read about black people. Lester Ward, a professor of sociology at Brown University, reasons that a black man is moved to rape a white woman because he realizes that mating with, quote, a more advanced being would, quote, raise his race to a little higher level. We have the Richard Examiner at this time writing that science has now shown that Negroes are not men, in the sense which that term is used by the Declaration of Independence. Again, it's this grading of certain human beings as less fit. Here's the editors of American Medicine. It's a journal in 1907. They say if you review the evidence, the scientific evidence, the Negro cannot comprehend higher studies any more than a horse can understand the rule of three. Now, I have to say, I don't even know what the rule of three is, so I guess I don't understand it either. But they conclude, quote, if these anatomical facts had been known at the end of the Civil War, then the country would not have made the tragic mistake of giving Negroes the right to vote. Quote, leaders in all political parties now acknowledge the air of human equality. This is as these Jim Crow policies are setting in place. It's also as lynching really takes hold. Lynching really begins in the 1890s, and you can see why if we're going to say certain people are enemies of the state. Now, here's a quote as from Charles Eliot, president of Harvard University at this time, as to why they basically do not want blacks and whites eating together. He says, in a democracy, civilized white men don't want to rub elbows with, quote, barbarous black men. Again, you see this eugenic idea. Now, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was founded in 1909. There's a meeting here in New York at the Charity Organization Hall, and it's called the National Negro Conference. And here's what's so telling. The very first presentation, and I always mispronounce, by W.E.B. Du Bois, the great, you know, black radical, so to speak, fighting for rights and all. His first question to the audience is this. He puts three brains on display. One's of an ape, one's of a black man, one's of a white man. Why is he doing this? Because he wants to show, is there some sort of gradation in the brains? Or are there two brains you can't tell anything apart? And of course, you can't. But the ape brain is notably different. But he does say this. Watch what he says. The very first question at the founding of the NAACP, he says this. From the standpoint of modern science, are Negroes men? And that's because in the eugenic sort of idea of unfit and grading of human beings is that they were not. There's some sense of that. So that's what he's fighting for. So what's my point here? Jim Crow, as you know, lasts, in essence, from the 1890s to the 1960s. It's 70 years. Jim Crow policies that prevent blacks from voting, etc., the segregation, etc. Can that happen if we do not have eugenic ideas towards certain people? I don't know. I think they go hand in hand about declaring certain people unfit and less than equal. All right. Now, if you write about that there's any eugenic ideas towards the mentally ill today, as I did not long ago, you will hear it, that people don't appreciate this thought. But let's go forward and see if there is any sort of similarity to some things that are happening today. First of all, when the antipsychotics come into psychiatric care in 1955, that's when Thorazine comes into asylum medicine. They're still doing surgical lobotomies. You know how they describe the drugs? As chemical lobotomies. But not negatively. That's positive. That means it's a drug substitute for a surgery that is seen as having a benefit. All I'm saying is there's a continuation now of a therapy that causes a change in being similar to what they saw with surgical lobotomy. And today, in modern histories, we say that Thorazine, the arrival of Thorazine, kicked off a psychopharmacological revolution as a great an advance in care as the introduction of antibiotics in asylum medicine. That's sort of the official history. But if we go back, the drugs are initially welcomed for causing a change in being similar to what you see in surgical lobotomy. So the devaluing, I think, is still present at that time. Now, how do we assess the merits of antipsychotics today? If you go in the literature as to why they're effective, it's two things. Well, basically, it's this. People come in an emergency room, you knock down the psychotic symptoms better than placebo. Okay? That's over 6 weeks. That's why the drugs are effective. Then they run these studies. They take away the drug, and those where the drug is taken away, they relapse. They have a return of psychotic symptoms greater than those in the drug-maintained group. What is relapse? It means you get rehospitalized. So you now are costing the society money, in essence. Does any of that literature tell you what people are doing? Does it tell you about whether they're working? Are they enjoying life? Are they mating with people? That sort of thing. And from 1945 to 1955, if you look at first episode schizophrenia patients, more than half were working at 5 years later. You'd see a lot actually marrying. There was an early study about two-thirds of the women actually were mating up. Go look at schizophrenia patients today, people so diagnosed. The employment rate is like 10%, and the percentage of people having kids is way, way down. Okay, and there's a lot of sexual dysfunction with the drugs. The point is, in how we assess the merits of treatments today for people with psychotic disorders, schizophrenia, etc., it's not about what they can do, and it's not about whether they're enjoying life or any of those measures. It's about whether or not they have symptoms that often land them back in the hospital. Okay, that's the what we measure. There's a recent study done by Martin Harrell. He's a University of Illinois College of Medicine. It's a long-term study. It's the only one we have that followed a group of psychotic patients from 1980 forward, 200 psychotic patients. Okay, he managed to keep 145 of these patients in his study for 15 and 20 years. The purpose of the study, the reason you all funded it as American taxpayers, was to see what happened to people who went off their meds. So in this study, everybody was treated conventionally with drugs, okay? And then they're just followed for 15 years. And he ends up with 64 schizophrenia patients. 25 are off, and the remaining part remain on drugs, 39. Well, what does he report? He reports the outcomes, and it's a naturalistic study. Everybody treated with drugs, and then he just follows them. People are free to go off, etc. And basically, as I said, 25 to 64 go off, and he follows them at 2, 4.5, 7.5, 10, and 15 years. What does he find? First of all, he finds that of those off medication, more than half work. Okay, more than half, about 40% of them become asymptomatic. They end up recovered, working, etc. The percentage that, so the recovery rate for those off medication, and recovery included working half time, was 40%. The percentage on medication was 5%. Okay? And all these things, on all his different outcome measures, there's a lot of outcome measures. The off medication group does markedly better every single measurement. Okay? In his milder psychotic disorders group, it's the same thing. Okay? It's those who get off do much, much better. And the other thing here is this. So many of them are just not psychotic, okay? The symptoms pass, they go back to work, etc. How many of you have heard of that study? Do you read about it in the New York Times?
No.
You read about it in any magazine? Okay, why not? It doesn't fit with the standard of care that does produce a lot of profits. All I want to say is this. So it doesn't fit with Martin Harrell, okay? He just came out with his 20-year data, and it's even more profound, this 20-year data. The differences are extraordinary. The recovery rate of those who stayed on medications through the 20 years, only 17% ever had a period of recovery. For those who got off medication and stayed off, 87% had sustained periods of recovery. It is dramatically different. But my point to you as a society, why don't we know this? You just said because of money, it does threaten a standard of care. Now let me ask you this. If you had heart patients where you had this sort of outcome of a medical treatment, would it be published?
No.
Who said no? You don't think it would be published?
No.
You're more cynical than even I am. I think it would be. I just don't think you're going to have a major study like this in heart. I think it's again a sign that we're not valuing certain groups of people as other groups of people. The other thing, and I'm not going to get into this because I have to too long, the whole chemical imbalance story, it's not true. Okay? If you actually talk to the researchers, they say, I was given a grand rounds at Massachusetts General Hospital a year ago in January. Many of you have read Anatomy of an Epidemic. You can see why people are unhappy with that book. So I'm there, and one of the things that the psychiatrists are complaining about is how I've said they told false stories about the mentally ill. And I said, well, you told us that we had chemical imbalances, and yet when you look about this, when you look at the research, you find it wasn't so. And this comes out. And you know what they told me? So what was their response? This is MGH, Massachusetts General Hospital, said, oh, we haven't been telling people, we haven't told people that for 25 years. We knew that was an outdated model 25 years ago. And I said to them this, it's true you did know, because actually that's when it fell apart. You did know that the chemical imbalance story was false 25 years ago. But I think you failed to communicate it to the public. And there were some heads nodding like that. There's a recent note, by the way, by Ronald Pies in Psychiatric Times. He says this. This theory of chemical imbalances is an urban myth. Okay? I don't know of any well-informed psychiatrist who ever proposed that chemical imbalances were a primary cause of mental disorders. He says it was only proposed by opponents of psychiatry to make psychiatrists look bad. I'm pretty sure that's not what happened. But the point is, what other group of people get told that they have something physiologically wrong when we don't know that to be true? Finally, there's this. You know, we're doing, so you know the broken brain idea, you have chemical imbalances? So the idea with a broken brain is, again, there's something fundamentally wrong with you, right? We have normal people over here, and we have people with broken brains. How different is that in terms of saying people who are fit and unfit? Especially when everything you can look at in the science tells you this. Anybody with the wrong stressors and all, wrong trauma, stopping to sleep, can move over here. By that I mean they can become psychotic, they can become manic, etc. And there's plenty of evidence that with the right care, once you have that, you can move back over here, and by that I mean not have such symptoms. But in order to sort of tell a story that helps sell drugs, we are being telling a story that either you have a broken brain, a chemical imbalance, and need drugs for life, or you're normal, right? That's still setting up this line that divides human beings into the fit and the unfit. And you also hear all these stories that they're finding genes for this and that, right? Well, they've been finding genes for that ever since Aaron Rosenthal in 1908 said there was a normal gene and the insane gene. Here's what I will tell you what happens with the genetics of mental disorders. There's always this announcement, we found the gene or genes, and then people try to replicate it and they can never really replicate it. So there's just some recent announcement, et cetera, et cetera. My favorite comment on this is by Andrew Scull, a British historian of medicine. He says, waiting for the discovery of the biological causes of mental illness is like waiting for Godot. It just never quite arrives. Anyway, I'll stop here. So the question for us, I think, as a society today, we look in the past, I think we're ashamed by eugenics, right? This sort of dividing of humans into the fits and unfits. We're ashamed by forced sterilization. And then my question to us as a society is, are we embracing eugenic conceptions today when we talk about chemical imbalances, etc.? Are we saying that there are normal and abnormal people? And what does that lend itself to? And also, you know where I was earlier today? And what happens to people when they get deemed abnormal and under state care? Where I was at earlier today, I was giving a talk to the Association of Lawyers who represent people who are being forcibly medicated and given forcible ECT. And they shared with me some of the court orders. Here's an example of one. One man was being ordered to have electroshock twice a week for 55 weeks. 150 forced electroshocks. Another one, 400 forced electroshocks. Not one, not two, 400. Others you would see drug ordered that would be like Haldol, a newer drug, a benzodiazepine, 5-6 drugs, forcibly medicated, etc. We also have an expansion of assisted outpatient commitment laws. You know what those are? What happens is you get released from the mental hospital, but you still don't really get your civil liberties back. And so you're allowed to be in the community, but you're forced to take drugs if you want to stay in the community. This is spreading like wildfire. Assisted outpatient. All I can say is if you're under an assisted outpatient order, you are not someone with full civil rights.
okay? Because you're being forced to take medications you may not want to take. So, are these medical policies, or are these social policies? And are they social policies? This is the question for you all. I'm pretty sure they're not born of good science, but do they reflect this thing that we as a society are continuing to say that there's this line separating the fit from the unfit, the normal from the abnormal? I think we still are embracing that same idea, and I think history is telling us it's not a good idea. So, thanks.
Now, we're going to hear the ensuing Q&A in a couple of minutes, slightly edited for clarity. But now let's have some light relief in the shape of Guitar Pill. This is Henry Phillips.
This is a song that goes out to all the aspiring guitar players out there. Don't you wish there was a pill you could take where you could instantly be able to play the guitar? Just like Eddie Van Halen or B.B. King or Segovia. And each of the various styles of these different guitar players would be represented by different kinds of pills. Like, for example, if you wanted to play like Eddie Van Halen, there'd be these bright red gelatin capsules you could take. And the B.B. King pills would be dark blue, and they'd be called blues. For obvious colloquial reasons. And they would ideally be washed down with a pint of early time. And the Segovia pills would be these little tiny brown pills. But they'd be the most powerful pills of all. Because he's really the best guitar player when you stop and think about it. I mean, that Spanish classical's really hard to play when you're drunk. And you could take one of these pills and be able to play like the guy on the label, like for about 3 hours. Like, let's say if you were at a party. If you wanted to impress your girlfriend, or maybe to impress your parents, let's say if they were just kind of undecided about you. And you wouldn't have to pay any dues, you wouldn't have to spend countless hours practicing all the damn time, you wouldn't have to suffer for your art. By suffering, I mean like not being able to go out on a Saturday night, you wouldn't have to worry about getting screwed over by a bunch of club owners and managers, and you wouldn't have to worry about having your kids hate you, or wife leave you, or getting arthritis, or dying in a plane crash just because of all the pain involved in getting that good. Wouldn't that be great? If there was a pill like that, wouldn't that be neat? Wouldn't that be neat?
Okay, so, I'll take some questions, and I see some hands. One, two, three, we'll start. Or maybe I'll change that a little bit.
The question is, what was there a working definition of unfit or defective? How would it manifest? What are the characteristics? If I'm walking down the street, or if I'm in a salon or a restaurant, how do I recognize somebody who's defective?
Right, so three points he's making here. One is, how did they figure out who was defective? Obviously, good question. One thing that would just go to people in prisons, asylums, and say, this is our defectives. But then they would also, the idea, you know, who's defective? Someone who's different from me is more likely to be seen as defective. In other words, who has different cultures, different behaviors, etc., different class. So someone who, and you can read about, say, someone's at a street corner preaching about, you know, class unfairness. Well, maybe that person is seen as deluded and now becomes seen as defective. Certainly, if someone has a genetic thing, you know, if they have Down syndrome, that sort of thing, mental retardation was seen as a sign of being defective. Anybody who was manic, psychotic in the hospital, that's defective. Criminals were seen as defective. Antisocial behavior is seen as defective. So it becomes this basically this mass of people who are different and in some ways are putting some financial burden on society in some ways.
So it's just sufficiently outside the dominant culture.
Basically, that's it, you know? And when they did this, they had 10% you saw when the field workers came out who were defective. Depending on how you define it, you could make 15%, 20%. That's number one. Psychoanalysis seems to be a counter to eugenic ideas. Yes, but who does psychoanalysis? Psychoanalysis was for the rich, for neurotic problems. It really wasn't even seen really for the psychotic patients and the low-class patients. So rather than seeing, it's almost like celebrating the complexity of the rich, right? And their extraordinary minds. Now, there was some effort to sort of apply psychoanalytic theory to, say, frontal lobotomy, and this is great stuff. They'll show, at one point, frontal lobotomy, why does it work? And had this one drawing, like, the doctor's coming in and he's untying the ego and the id and he's separating them out. It's complete ridiculousness. But that's the difference on psychoanalytic. I mean, it's really a different class of patients. So you can see why they can still be in the same society. And then the third question of DSM-3. DSM-3 is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It comes in 1980. The importance is this. Prior to DSM-1 and DSM-2 are not strict boundaries of normal and abnormal, okay? There's this sort of spectrum of neuroses, et cetera. There's sort of psychodynamic conceptions. 1980, they're going to say mental disorders are brain diseases, just like heart disease, et cetera. And you either have it or you don't. That's sort of the idea. You either have major depression, you either have schizophrenia, or you don't. You know, and they have these ideas to draw a line. The line is completely arbitrary, but that's not what they say. So yeah, this is the point. DSM-3, with this idea that there's this fine line, you either have a broken brain or you don't, really sort of sets up again this idea of fit and unfit, right? And again, it's not transient. It's you. You are bipolar. You are schizophrenic. You have a chemical imbalance. So the DSM-3 really is identifying this line. And the crazy thing is with, you know, we now have DSM-4 and DSM-5, is it's also married, of course, to commercial purposes that want to expand the boundaries of the abnormal as greatly as possible. I've been doing a lot of talks recently in different schools, colleges. What percentage of entering freshmen in colleges now arrive with a diagnosis and a prescription? Any idea?
I'm just going to throw out a random guess, 40-50%.
Okay, what I'm hearing is 30%, okay? So think about this. 30% of our freshmen, our 18-year-olds, have now grown up in a society that say they're not quite right. Boy, that is a lot of...
High-functioning 18-year-olds who are in college.
Yeah, these are people going to Dartmouth. Yeah. I was at Dartmouth. This is people at the best schools. Exactly right. I gave a talk at this Association of Liberal Arts Colleges in New England, and they're actually studying this, and they're up to 28%. These are the kids getting, like, you know, 2200s on their SATs or whatever. You know, it's just crazy. But anyway, going to this These kids are getting the message that they're bipolar, they're ADHD, they're not quite right.
Does the Snopes trial tie into the eugenics movement as a counter reaction? And my second question is, today you see the elites that have made public their mental problems, bipolar disorders, manic depression, and so forth.
So the Snopes trial, of course, is the famous trial with on the theory of evolution, basically, right? And also goes to the sense of, God, I got to remember exactly the Snopes trial. It's Clarence Darrow, right?
It's in the 20s.
It's in the 20s, but it has to do with whether human beings evolve or not, right? And the teaching of that.
Whether human beings
are descended from apes.
Are descended from apes, or they have an inner quality. They're humans. They're
right.
Beings in
or heaven. Made by God, so to speak.
Made by God. Yes, yeah. It is. But is it a reaction to the eugenics movement? The scientific.
Oh, that's a good question.
Scientific movement. Two irrational ideas clashing.
I'd say yes. I mean, in a certain sense, is. The idea that species evolve is associated with the eugenics movement, right? I mean, they come out of Darwin. So you have, this is they're sometimes odd bedfellows, right? So in some ways, of course, we see scientists that embrace evolution as, you know, smart, right? That's what educated, thoughtful people do. And that's really what Clarence Darrow is defending in his notes, is that trial and the right to teach evolution. The problem is, what happens with eugenics is an example of science being put to a bad end. So that's really the difference here. I think you can defend evolution, of course, but that doesn't mean you should be characterizing people as unfit and unfit. So that's how that's different. And then the second thing you just asked, I'm sorry?
About the elites in our country.
Right.
That are not inhibited from explaining that they have mental disorders.
Right.
And in some cases, they are on medication.
Right.
Tournaments, the news, magnet. And other Hollywood people and so forth, political figures.
Right. Well, one of the things that the pharmaceutical psychiatry complex, so to speak, has done a very good job of is basically selling medications. And, you know, in 1987, for example, we spent $800 million in psychiatric medications in this country. In 2007, we spent $40 billion. That's a 50-fold increase. So, basically, this capitalistic enterprise of selling medications and getting people diagnosed, you know, through advertising, et cetera, has been very good at getting us to see ourselves as bipolar or, you know, ADHD, et cetera, et cetera. So they've done very good at expanding the boundaries of what we consider disordered, I guess, you know, psychiatrically troubled. But why are the elite embracing this? I don't know. I don't really know on this. This is really a good question because actually, you know, it's part of a larger philosophical change that I don't really, you can see I'm stumbling on this. In 1987, the NIMH conducted a survey of the American population about depression. And the population said this, depression passes, and two, you have to make changes in response to depression. You go to a counselor, etc., and you make changes in your life. There's things that are making you unhappy. So it's seen as two things. Within yourself, you're empowered to make changes, and it will pass. Then what happened is the NIMH then began running a campaign. It was called the DART campaign. It was funded partially by Eli Lilly. And it was done to convince Americans that depression is a brain disease, okay? And it's permanent, and you need to be on Prozac, and that it's caused by low serotonin. And today, 80% of Americans know that depression is caused by low serotonin. Now, it's not true, but they know that. It's an example of how successful this storytelling has become. And what it's done is shift us as a people of philosophy away from self-resilience and sort of self-responsibility for your own mind. My own opinion is one of the things we humans do is we're born with this mind and we spend a lot of times grappling with it and trying to make peace with it. That's sort of a fundamental thing human beings do. I actually don't think it's that easy being human. Your mind can be a very troubled place. But that's part of what used to be life. That was part of the existential struggle. And we've changed that. And now we have this idea that we're sort of victims, right? We're not self-responsible. It's our... Why it's being embraced by the elite, I don't quite know, but that somehow it's being done. And I just don't have a good answer for you.
It's anti-stigma. It was like a movement against the stigma of mental illness.
Right.
Which was like there was families of the mentally ill.
Right.
That was the pharmaceutical industry.
Right. The pharmaceutical industry would fund this. You also did have, NAMI got behind this. And NAMI, of course, were mothers who were being blamed for schizophrenic sons and daughters. So they wanted to get out of it. By the way, as they run anti-stigma campaigns in country after country, stigma goes up. One of the things that happened with this talk, I was talking sort of about the mentally ill, but there's a whole story to be done about race. You're absolutely true. My third book, actually, called On the Laps of Gods, got started out with this question. Why do we imprison black men at such a high rate? So there's no ethnic group anywhere in the United States, anywhere in the world, that is imprisoned at the rate of black men in the United States. So actually, I was beginning to try to do the same thing I'd done for Imagine America with the Mentally Ill, was to trace the history of blacks in the criminal justice system. And I got lost because of this extraordinary case in 1919. It's a racial history. This presents American criminal law in a very different case. And the heroes is really the first great civil rights attorney in the United States, Hispanic Cyprian Attorney General. But here's your point. When do blacks start being imprisoned at great, great rates? What year? 1965. So you have the Voting Rights Act, and next thing you know, you have drug acts that start imprisoning, and I worked in Attica prison, by the way, in the 1970s. And I came in right after the riots, or shortly after the riots. And so what do you find there? You find guys selling drugs. I mean, that's why they were there, sort of entrepreneurs there. That basically were following, certain opportunities. And next thing you know, they're in Attica, they're in these prisons, etc. So this is what the book's talking about, as how they are disenfranchising blacks today.
And who is the they?
Well, that's a good question. Who do you think is the they?
Well, I would say that it's a system of the capitalist class. But I want you to say, because you're the one who come to talk
to. Well, sure, come on. There's a ruling group here, right?
I mean, there's a ruling. You say it because you see you have credentials and blah, blah, blah. I'm the lady in the back who makes the comments. So it's very
Listen, I mean, here's one of the things that I think we need histories. We need to have histories. People's histories, as opposed to histories of the winners, so to speak. Because, so often the history that is told in the United States really is a history sort of told by the elite, etc. What Michelle Alexander has done in this book, she's getting us a way to look at this, how the system is disenfranchising huge blocks of voters, etc. Why is that? Well, I think you have to see it tied to the Voting Rights Act. That's my feeling. So, and now clearly there are groups in power, who those groups are, that have a certain desire to maintain certain status quos, right? And certain... So, the point, we're also seeing in the United States, it's both class and race. We're becoming a very class-rigid society. Even there's less class movement than in a lot of European societies today. I'm not a scholar of this sort of... class rigidity. I'm not a scholar really of, say, where are the origins of these policies that do disenfranchise groups in so many different ways.
But you could become that, because then what that does is give us hope as how to transform it. Is if we know, it's a capitalist class, it's a capitalist system that makes this happen, then we say, so we need to get rid of that system so that we can transform these ideas, policies, and action.
Well, I mean, you certainly can see, listen, as we know, there's the money's being ever more concentrated at the very top, right? And just listen to this. So one of the ideas is, we can't tax the rich because they make all the jobs, right? We hear this about the Republicans, etc. And you hear that repeated in certain media. Well, that's a story about how the fit, so to speak, need to be favored in our society. I mean, it's completely ludicrous. You know, one small thing. My daughter teaches high school in a Brooklyn high school. And, you know, her tax rate is about, I don't know, by the time you add up all the taxes, it's like 40, 45%. You know, Warren Buffett's paying 18% or something, or 15%. So my daughter's paying like three times what Warren Buffett's paying. I mean, it's just so insane. And obviously, we're having these things because, you know, there's a certain ruling elite, obviously, what's happening. Look at the Supreme Court decision that said, you know, corporations are people, that sort of thing. By the way, the corporations are people, that goes back to decisions made in the 1890s. So the 14th Amendment was passed to give equal rights and the protection of the Constitution to the freedmen, right? That's why we have the 14th Amendment. And you can read in a series of decisions in the late 1800s in which, in essence, the U.S. Supreme Court withdraws the protection of the 14th Amendment to protect the rights of the freedmen, right? At the same time, they are using the 14th Amendment to protect the rights of railroad owners. So that decision goes back to the 1890s, a discredited decision. Anyway, these are great points. And as women, there's a long thing about diagnosing women, sending women off to the mental asylum, that sort of thing. One great study. Now you got me going. Okay, one real quick study. There was a study done in which they had symptoms that they went to psychiatrists. And the symptoms were the same in every case note, except one thing was changed in this study. It was identified either as black male, black female, white female. And then what's the diagnosis? So which group was most likely to be diagnosed schizophrenic? Same symptoms. What's that? Black male. What was second? Black female. Most likely. Third? White female. The least likely to be diagnosed schizophrenic was white men. Why? Because white men were doing the diagnosis.
Thanks, Bob. Just a couple quick questions. What were the number of book sales with regards to eugenics as far as how are these being read popularly throughout the United States? And when did eugenics stop being taught in universities? Also, who's paying for the sermons as far as the funding of those prizes? And then there's a new theory out, a book out, talking about Darwin as being the greatest economist ever, right? And so there's thought as far as with that. And I'm not sure if you know, as far as the OSS, which was a predecessor to the CIA, that the funding for that, the anthropologists were being funded by the foundations, like Rockefeller, exact same foundations that were funding the eugenics programs. And their anthropological viewpoints and their studies that they were doing on indigenous people around the world echo as far as the eugenics, but also that as far as capitalism, as far as being put forward. And my question for you is, that how did eugenics play in the story of the development of capitalism and how capitalism was spun in the U.S., but also as it was propagated imperialistically across the world? And if you look at that as far as like the funding of the foundations, because it's the exact same funding mechanisms, same funding sources.
Okay, a lot of questions there. Just a couple things. In 1937, Fortune surveyed the population. 67% of Americans favored forced sterilization. Okay, so that tells you it's popularizing. It begins to fall out of favor, though, in the late 30s and early 40s, because once we start fighting Nazi Germany, okay, and there's some recognition that Germany is a eugenics country. And especially after 1945, it becomes a discredited science, and it gets swept from our textbooks, the history of eugenics, basically, because it's associated with the Holocaust. So that's that. What was the question on the capitalism?
to what extent did the speaking of eugenics, the whole story of eugenics, affect the story of capitalism?
Okay, I can answer
this. Because the titans of industry, Carnegie, Rockefeller, et cetera, that are funding this, right. But they're also the titans who are pushing this form of capitalism that we have.
Right,
today.
So you can see how they somewhat go hand in hand. And almost, you know, when the CEOs are getting like $50 million to run a company? There was just an article, a column in the Boston Globe. They really believe they're worth it? That's sort of the sense of I'm the most fit, right? I'm the superior human being. And it's part of the idea if you're running a big company, a a successful capitalistic company, it is survival of the fittest, right? And so the rewards go to the most fit companies. It doesn't go to those who manage to capture markets, that sort of thing. So if we see the rise of capitalism in the and the real embrace in the 1880s, 1890s, their influence over the Supreme Court, etc., that would be a great study. How much do eugenic ideas go hand in hand with the rise of the railroads? I don't know. You're shaking your heads. I don't know. It'd be a great study. Two separate things.
I mean, everything's interrelated.
Yeah, so. Two separate things. And I'm not the guy to assess this. So, anyway.
We're being taught that the only mental illness that has a genetic, a proven genetic component is schizophrenia. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Sure. I was giving grand rounds recently at Western Kentucky, and I give a little talk, and the head of research goes, "All this research is worthless." Why? He says, "There's no such thing as schizophrenia." Schizophrenia is a term for a lot of different sort of symptoms. And anybody really in the field talks about a group of schizophrenias. So really you're talking about many different things. So how can there be one schizophrenic gene or one group when you're talking about many different things? There was there's a couple things with the genetics in schizophrenia. Some of that data actually goes back to Nazi Germany, okay, that is used to say that there's some vulnerability. I think there may be, in some instances, some genetic vulnerability to psychosis. I really do. That's a lot different than saying there's a gene for schizophrenia or that it's just a genetic disease. But I do think there can be some vulnerabilities to stress, trauma, disorganization, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the answer. Yeah?
I have a question and a comment. The question I also had when I was reading Anatomy of an Epidemic, and it's about the longitudinal study that you mentioned today. Do those studies control at all, since these are episodic illnesses and long-term illnesses, do they control at all for people who go off medication because they're better? I mean, it seems like a lot of people who have episodic illnesses, and schizophrenia has a course that can either get better, stay the same, or get worse. So it would seem to me that a lot of people who get off medication do better because they feel better, they get off medication, and they don't relapse.
Right.
So they do better.
Right.
Which is different than trying to encourage people that if they get off medication, they'll do better, and the medication is making them sick.
Yeah. Go ahead. That's the question.
That's the question. And
the comments.
That at least we should, I think, mention in this kind of group the recovery movement, which is a growing movement among, and you did mention it in your book, which is a growing movement among people diagnosed with mental illnesses themselves. Their slogan is a lot of nothing about us without us. They call themselves things like survivors of the mental health system. And they figure out good stuff.
What was the last thing I'm sorry?
They figure out a lot of good things, a lot of
right, sort of self-determination. So.
Self-determination and feelings of, lots of ways that you can live in the world. There isn't just one standard of how you can live.
Right.
And I think it's, the research shows that there, a lot of them do pretty well.
My name is Seth Farber. I'm an anti-establishment psychologist. I've written four or five books, and my last one just came out. You can get it at Amazon. It's Bob wrote one of the people who wrote endorsements for it, and it's called The Spiritual Gift of Madness. And it's, the subtitle is The Failure of Psychiatry and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. So I talk about how the Mad Pride Movement begun in the history of it, beginning in the mental patients' liberation, the psychiatric survivors, and now more popular term is the Mad Movement. Anyway, I go into theory and as well as history and what's going on today. So I just want to mention, I have a press release if you want to pick it up, and you can get this at on Amazon.
So let me answer your question about just about people who are better going off that, say, have an episodic form of the disorder. And that's what you're seeing. By the way, in the anatomy of an epidemic, I'm not encouraging, that's not a medical advice book, right?
No, I know.
Yeah, I'm not encouraging anybody to go off meds. I just think we need to know this information. Here's the thing, with, so the Martin Harrell study, if you read it, it makes it seem that that's what's happening, okay? He says it's those with a good prognosis who are going off meds and doing better. So it's not the meds. It's just that there's a subset of people, perhaps with a lot milder form, who are going off and doing well. The problem is that interpretation is belied by the evidence itself. So within the good prognostic categories, those who got off did better than those who did on, stayed on. In the bad prognostic category, those who got off did better than those who stayed on. Most importantly, those with milder disorders initially who stayed on meds did worse than schizophrenia patients who got off. So that's that milder group would have a better prognosis. So again, I'm not saying anything about whether people should be taking meds or not. I just think this needs to be known as part of what is the information that's out there. My own interpretation of the Harrell study, though, is it's pretty damning evidence that over the long term, the drugs worsen the long-term course of psychotic disorders. And he's got a new paper coming out that he basically raises that question in the 20 years. But that's my interpretation of the data that he presents.
The only thing I want to say, and I think I actually agree with you, but the only thing I want to say is that prognosis in schizophrenia and depression is very tricky. Some could be extremely severely depressed or psychotic and get better and never have another episode. So what you guess is going to happen isn't. It's not like in cancer sometimes it might be easier to decide a prognosis from what
you see. Well, I completely agree with you that these were often episodic problems. We've sort of reconceived them as chronic problems. But if you actually look at the data, they were often episodic. The only thing I'm saying is when we go back to that initial group of patients in the Harrell group, we don't know who's going to be episodic and who's not. We have these different subsets. And in every subset, it was those who got off who did much better.
One is, can you comment about the use of pharmaceutical drugs on children who seem to have no rights regarding the use of drugs? And there's a new diagnosis, I don't know how new it is, but there's something called ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder,
right,
which pretty much describes every teenager,
right,
anyone's ever seen. So that's one question. The second thing is, can you comment about talking about ODD? Probably everybody at the Brett Forum has this disease. But is there any indication that... is there any indication that the government is trying to, like, or is thinking about this as, thinking of pharmaceuticals as a way of mass control of people, given the, you know, the rise of the popular uprising of the 99%, the massive demonstrations in Greece, etc. And I'm not, of course, including conspiracy theories like use of, you know, fluoride in the water, or chemtrails where everybody's being dosed, etc.
Listen, you can see the medicating of kids to a capitalistic climate. It's basically about market expansion. So you basically say, for example, the SSRI antidepressants. They first are prescribed to adults in the early 1990s. The drug companies were saying that the adult market was saturated, and they began looking for the children's market as an untapped market. And, you know, then they began, and when they tested antidepressants on children, they weren't even effective over the short term, by and large. Didn't matter. They kept on prescribing them anyway. So that's one expansion. Why do we get juvenile bipolar disorder all of a sudden out there? It didn't used to happen. Well, what happened was a man named Joseph Biederman was paid $1.3 million to recategorize oppositional defiant disorder as juvenile bipolar disorder, and by doing so, open up the prescribing of atypical antipsychotics to that group. So I don't think it has, in a sense, any government design of mass control or anything like that. I think it has to do with corporations that expand markets for their products, and children were an untapped market. They've done it very, very, very successfully. I will say one thing. I don't know if this woman is still here about the Klassenol. If you look what's happening to your kids in foster care, it's just horrific.
Yeah.
What's happening in foster care is just a shame beyond belief. I just did a chapter for a book, and it's something like over 50% of foster care kids who are teenagers are on antipsychotics. They're not on antipsychotics because they're psychotic. They're on antipsychotics to sort of curb, you know, quiet them, curb their aggression, that sort of thing. So anyway, to my mind, the medicating of kids is a story of capitalism run amok. And the kids are not consenting at all. I've talked to many foster care kids who come out of this, and they are angry beyond belief, and they have a right to be angry. You know, sexual dysfunction, all sorts of problems. I think there will be a day of reckoning with the medicating of kids, and it will be seen as one of the worst moments in our history. I think what's being done to kids is atrocious.
I want to thank you so much. And I also want to thank Seth. I'm a mental patient, but I have also earned a PhD in the 20-some-odd years that I've been in and out of mental institutions. I'm actually an episodic. I was sexually abused at 10 years old by a Catholic priest, and it happened in a church, and he brought me in the back where the priest changed the vestments. He sexually abused me, and I lost my mind for the first time. Periodically, episodically, when I'm under tremendous stress and pressure and anxiety and worry and things go on in my life like anyone else's life, I lose it. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, and my truth has been rewritten, and I've been lied about in psychiatric records, and it happens. And a Washington, D.C. reporter wrote a book called Crazy about his son's experience with so-called mental illness, and he reported in his book how he was instructed to lie by the emergency room staff about his son. He had to say that his son was attempting to kill him in order to have the son committed, because the commitment laws have it that you have to be a danger to yourself or others in order to justify the commitment.
I definitely like a lot of the analysis you did on eugenics, and you mentioned at least in the response that it's the attitude towards science that's also in play here. You also were talking a bit about how we're waiting for Godot to some degree as for like these tests, but you know, I think if we were to speculate a little, I think that at some point in the next couple of years, it's almost inevitable that the same forces that bought Biedermann will also buy either a definitive neurochemical neuroimaging or genetic proof of disease and disorder, unless there's some advantages to keep it ambiguous to expand the diagnostic net. So the question then is, like, if science is being appropriated in the name of marketing, right, what sorts of strategies and rhetoric do you think can work against or resist this wielding of fact to short-circuit debate? Like, how do we continue to humanize these stories? And, you know, what is the most effective strategy for kind of trying to present and convince and persuade with this material? I'm not convinced that it's actually the stats are convincing anyone.
And the author concluded that people telling their own personal stories of what actually happened to them is a good way to counter institutional propaganda. I think that's true in general. And I thank Lynn Gerry for starting this radio collective, which has helped me to see the world in a new light. And I hope to help spread the conversation about the kind of world that we want to live in and we want our children to grow up in. Now, if you'd like to listen to this show again or any previous episodes, you can do so from our webpage at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. Now, last week I added a category gallery, which I hope you will find helpful. One of the radio show producers asked me today about making an iTunes podcast. If you've got any experience with that, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has filled in some historical gaps for you, and if you find it thought-provoking, why not share your thoughts with someone close to you?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Abby Martin, Global Conflict and Independent Media. At the beginning of May 2018, the Union for Democratic Communications held a conference in Chicago on media, resistance, and justice. It was attended by journalists, media producers, policy analysts, academics, and activists. They want to stem the tide of misinformation and omission. The internet and alternative independent broadcasters have made some extraordinary contributions, and you probably are hearing this program on one of those pod or broadcasts. But compared to the millions reached by for-profit broadcasters, they have only small audiences. Abby Martin bridges both worlds. However, the networks she was and is affiliated with, Russia Today, RT, and Telesur, are shunned and denigrated by the current U.S. government and the corporate media. Her journalism is considered a threat to national security by the same interests who lied the U.S. into war against Iraq, claiming that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was involved in the 9/11 attacks. Born in Oakland in 1984, Abby Martin had already started her own anti-war citizens journalism project in 2009 with the still active website Media Roots. Then the Occupy movement began in late 2011. RT, aka Russia Today, was the only TV network that had a dedicated presence in Oakland. Abby Martin came to know the staff and became liaison for Occupy Oakland. She was invited to join the Washington, D.C. Bureau of RT, connecting with Chris Hedges, who still works there. Her program, Breaking the Set, ran for 3 years until 2015. Today she's hosting the Empire Files from New York City, with distribution on the satellite TV network Telesur. Abby Martin spoke on May 11, 2018, about her experience at RT and press freedom, reporting from Palestine and covering Venezuela. And she explained the rationale for her current show, Empire Files. Abby is introduced by Lee Arts, Professor of Media Studies, Purdue University Northwest.
I want to talk about another social theorist that you may know from popular culture, Chumbawamba. This is the 10th anniversary of their song, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And I would argue that everything that you have read in the news, the commercial news media, is wrong. New York Times, NPR, MSNBC. You notice I'm not talking about Fox. What do you know about Yemen? What do you know about Iran? What do you know about Korea? What do you know about the prosperity of the United States, that more than half of the people in this country do not make $35,000 a year? What do you know about police violence? 1,500 people were killed last year. ISIS, Brazil, fake news. Compare Charlottesville and what you know about Charlottesville with what you know about Ferguson if you read the New York Times or listen to MSNBC. Who deported more people, Trump or Obama? Who sent more drones, Trump or Obama? The list, it could go on. Do you know that the National Endowment for Democracy in the United States has funded to the tune of $30 million disruption, sabotage, organizing? This is not Russian intervention in an election. This is direct
U.S. intervention from the National Endowment for Democracy. And you can read it. Don't take my word for it. Don't take fake news for it. Go to the National Endowment for Democracy and see why they fund disruption in Venezuela, because they say they think participatory democracy is a bad thing. The problem here is that there are not voices that have truth that goes beyond truthiness, which is why we have this panel on global crises and independent media. Because without independent media, without participatory media, without people that are actually living their daily lives, having an opportunity to speak and broadcast, not on the internet that becomes increasingly tightened, not on Facebook, not on Twitter, but actually being able to broadcast to millions of people. That requires a change of the structure of the media in this country and other countries. What if that media spanned a continent, which is what Telesur does, Television of the South, that's based in Venezuela, but it has participants from Bolivia, Argentina, Cuba, other countries. So I'm very pleased to have as our final speaker and our guest this evening, Abby Martin, who's a journalist and presenter on Telesur, the lead on Empire Files, which is an investigative news program on Telesur. Abby Martin.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming out. It's a cold day. It's been a long day. My name's Abby, as he said. I'm the host of the Empire Files on Telesur. And the show just starts with the U.S. as the central point, right? The U.S. empire should be the starting point from basically every issue internationally and domestic. How has the world been shaped by those who have won, right, and colonized the planet? And in terms of on the domestic front, every issue needs to be seen through the egregious, outrageous amount that we spend on our military spending, right? We spend more than the next 12 countries combined. We have an empire that's the largest empire the world's ever seen, with 900 bases that we know about. If you ask Pentagon officials, they'll say they actually don't even know because of the amount of lily pad bases that spawn off of that. And what does this do to the American psyche on a domestic front? You know, the militarization of the police, the toxic masculinity, all these things from the top down, how is that affecting us to be empire babies, right? And what does the U.S. do? It enforces its economic hegemony through brutal and violent militarism all around the world. In Latin America alone, we've intervened in 56 times in different countries to usurp the democratic processes to secure U.S. business interests just in Latin America. The U.S. consumes the world's most energy. The Pentagon is the world's largest polluter. It's exempt from all climate treaties. And the U.S. government, as the moral arbitrator of the world, telling who can and who can't have nuclear weapons, supplies 70% of the world's dictatorships with weapons and training. Can you believe that? 70%. So, of course, all of this that I just outlined is not permitted on the corporate media. You'll never hear this framing, right? You'll never hear the debate. When I bring up that the U.S. is an empire, people think I'm talking about Star Wars. That's how limited the debate and dialogue is about something that affects the entire planet and is subjugating most of humanity. So corporate media doesn't just serve as a vehicle for advertising for defense contractors, banks, weapons, right? It serves to protect and promote the U.S. empire. It tells us who our friend and our foe is, right? Who's our friend? Well, Saudi Arabia and Israel. Who's our foe? Venezuela. Venezuela, Iran, Russia, Syria, North Korea, right? What do these have in common? Well, they're not enslaved to U.S. economic hegemony. They haven't laid down like carpets to U.S. capital and militarism. You know, we hear about state media, right, this Russian propaganda apparatus, and they bemoan apparatuses like RT, Russia Today, or Telesur, a Latin American conglomerate that I work for. But Al Jazeera is lauded. This is a Qatari theocratic dictatorship with literal slave markets. So why is that the case? Why is some state media okay and some is not? You know, why is it okay to have France 24, BBC, Voice of America? The corporate media might as well be state media. We all know this. It acts literally as an extension of the state, and it serves empire. In fact, it's weaponized to serve empire. We need to think of corporate media not as just these three or four networks, not as just, you know, MSNBC, Fox, NBC. We need to think of it at all the extensions off of that, because it's all funded by the same people with the same interests, right? Vox, Daily Beast, all of these millennial rebranding of corporate media for my generation and those younger than me. Vice is actually one of the worst offenders because they've just rebranded this kind of imperialist propaganda in terms of their foreign policy. They open their newsrooms to the Obama administration like that's cool. You don't lay down for power and embrace them into your studio. That's wrong. So that really disgusts me. You know, living in D.C., D.C. journalists are just stenographers for power. They tell the narrative set by the power brokers, and they just want access to that next White House correspondence dinner. That's all that matters to them. The New York Times and Washington Post so-called papers of record are actually the premier purveyors of fake news. They post continuous war propaganda, and they just cite anonymous government officials to sell these wars over and over again. Look no further than the Iraq War, as you all well know. You know, going back to the whole subsidization, or the media being subsidized by defense contractors, oil companies, and banks, after Trump bombed Syria last month, CNN basically did a three-minute infomercial for Tomahawk missiles for Raytheon. It was called Inside a Tomahawk Missile Factory. It took you through and just showed you how cool it was and how great Tomahawk missiles are after they killed a bunch of innocent people in Syria. CNN is amazing to me because they pretend like they're, you know, under attack from the Trump administration. Look at our press freedom is under attack. When's the last time they talked about journalists being executed in Israel? You tell me. So don't feign that this is some, you know, this bullshit that Trump is criticizing them. Oh, what about the war on whistleblowers? What about the war on journalists and press here? What about that? All you have is this bipartisan push for war with a parading rotation of generals and defense contractors that will tell you who we need to bomb and how we're not bombing them enough already. And when you look at the neoliberal blob, is what I like to call it, they pretend on one hand Trump is this mentally unfit next Hitler, yet on the other hand they want him to start multiple wars on multiple fronts with nuclear-armed nations. It's quite astounding. You know, they never criticize him for the right things. What about upping drone strikes 400%, carpet bombing civilians? Where's their criticism on that? You know, I'm just going to give just a couple quick stories that elucidate what I'm talking about from my own personal experiences working from RT to Telesur to being in some of these countries that the corporate media incessantly propagandizes us about, tells us, you know, who the enemies are and who the dissenters are, and those are our enemies as well. There are outlets, of course, that don't rely on corporate sponsorship. These rely on state funds. They fit outside this hegemony of Western corporate domination, and they allow the space for radical voices that rebuke corporate power, rebuke war. One of those is Russia Today. Love it or hate it, there's a reason why I went there. There's a reason why anti-imperialist journalists like Chris Hedges are there right now to talk about real issues. The funding is in the name, right? Russia Today. No, it's not the cartoonish depiction of a Putin propaganda roundtable discussion where we have, you know, Putin in our ear every day. I was able to pave more editorial freedom at that network than anyone on the corporate media. I was able to pave so much editorial freedom that I actually spoke out against Putin multiple times, did rigorous debates about Putin's policies, spoke about the MH17 downing. That is incredible. I mean, think about that. What that shows me is that all these corporate news anchors, you know, Phil Donahue can't say the same thing. He was fired after speaking out against the Iraq War. Cenk Uygur got fired after speaking out against Obama on MSNBC. What does that tell you about the so-called Putin propaganda network that I was able to have the main opinion show for an entire year after speaking out? That's amazing. And, you know, call me crazy, but I think that as this establishment is fomenting a Cold War with Russia, that we should have the Russian perspective. I want the Russian perspective in a world dominated by Western corporate media. That should be something that we actually intake as media-literate, critical-thinking people. I think that we can handle that, right? We don't need someone to tell us what we can and can't watch. So fast forward 2 years after after my show was over on RT, and we're all waiting with bated breath for this Russian intelligence report that proves Russian meddling in the election. And so I was quite alarmed to see that half of the report was actually just about RT. It It wasn't proof at all about Russia interfering in the election. It was literally just about how RT programming foments radical discontent, specifically my show. My show, it zeroed in on. So I'm sorry for Trump. The intelligence community actually said that I was a reason, right? That's how insane the discourse has gotten, so I apologize. And what was the show covering? No, it did not praise Putin. No, we didn't whitewash any crimes about Russia. No, we didn't whitewash the egregious inequality in the nation. What was it covering? It was covering real issues about America. That's the threat to them. That is the threat. So what are they saying? What did they say in the intelligence report? Well, they said my show that covered fracking, Occupy Wall Street, greed, inequality, Hillary Clinton, that is fomenting radical discontent. That's Russian propaganda. So it's Russian propaganda to talk about the reality of this country. It's Russian propaganda to talk about how half of the people living in this country are living paycheck to paycheck. That's Russian propaganda? Talking about reality? All right. This is what's so amazing to me. These same people that sold us the Iraq War, right? The architects and the WMD propagandists. Where are they now? They're right on the Russia beat. These are now the so-called resistance leaders. These are the people who are planting the seeds about how everything that I just mentioned is so-called Russian propaganda. If you criticize the murderous foreign policy of the U.S., you are a stooge for the Kremlin. Jill Stein is now a stooge for the Kremlin, right? Because she's criticizing war. It's unbelievable. So these are the Russia experts today, the Bill Kristols, the Michael Chertoffs. And what is this doing? This is all laying the framework, right? This is all laying the framework for just more crackdowns on civil liberties, more crackdowns on internet freedom. They want us to think our enemies are not those people far away who rule over us with offshore tax havens. Those aren't our enemies. Our enemies are us. They're your friends, they're your allies, they're your neighbors. Ooh, so don't trust them. Yeah, forget about the people who actually control things, right? Just focus on people like me, people like Project Censored, people like Jill Stein. So we're living in a discourse right now where we just have mass hallucinations. Everything is either fake news that's not subservient to their dear leader Trump, or Russian propaganda that dares to question reality. Telesaur is a little bit different than RT. This grew out of a contagion of this progressivism, these progressive revolutionary movements, out of a entity that was ravaged by colonialism. Latin America was ravaged by colonialism. It saw revolutions, counter-revolutions. Chavez's victory in 1999 sparked a contagion in the region. They called it the Pink Tide. There were several electoral victories of progressive leaders, and Telesaur was an outgrowth of this pan-Latin American unity and independence. Because they saw the corporate media apparatus as a weapon, right? It was being weaponized to destroy their countries, like it is all over the world, and overthrow their democratically elected governments. So Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, in accordance with six Latin American countries, Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Uruguay, and Ecuador, all came together to form this alternative to the corporate media stranglehold called Telesaur. I have 100% editorial freedom. I sell my show to Telesaur, and I have had nothing vetted. I've interviewed President Correa several times. I've interviewed the defense minister of Venezuela. I have never had anyone look over my questions, look over my material, and never tell me what to do. And I've been on the ground to see with my own eyes how the corporate media is uniformly lying to us about every single issue that I just talked about and pushing false narratives all the time. I went to Palestine for a month, and I'm a pariah in the corporate press because of this. We all know what happens to people who dare to question the 100% pro-Israel narrative that's forced down our throats. The only time Palestinian humanity is discussed is when there's egregious war crimes, and sometimes not even that. The Great March of Return, where countless unarmed protesters have been executed, thousands maimed, shot with live ammunition, the targeting of journalists, children, rescue workers. The media calls it clashes. New York Times says, oh, more people died in clashes. You mean snipers standing 100 yards away and just executing people through scopes? Oh, that's an interesting clash. You know, back in 2014, during the last egregious massacre in Gaza where 500 children were killed, I remember the New York Times, I'll never forget this, it said missile finds people watching the World Cup in a cafe. The missile was just walking along the beach and just found people and then decided to blow up. That's how passive the New York Times talks about massacres when it comes to Israel. They call it the most complicated issue in the world. It's very, very simple, actually. It's an apartheid state that is openly, ethnically cleansing an indigenous population and has been for the last 60 years. This is an untouchable issue. You are smeared and vilified. It's completely third rail. And what happens to people who dare to talk about this? Well, I'll just tell you what happened to me. I mean, I was banned from Gaza. I was called an Iranian agent. I thought I was a Russian agent, so I'm confused about, you know, I can't keep track. So the Israeli government pretty much told me that I'm banned from looking at one of the gravest humanitarian crises this world has ever seen, that I pay with my tax dollars. And Stand With Us, which is basically a propaganda extension of the Israeli government, smeared the hell out of me, right? I went on the Joe Rogan show, talked about this on probably the biggest platform that has been talked about, and they smeared me, they threatened him with a defamation lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes on and on and on. Obviously, we use Israel for battering ram in the Middle East. We could just see no further than what's going on in Syria, using it to bomb, right, time and again. And it's surrounded by these post-colonial states, some of which are still independent. So, of course, we want Israel as this garrison state there to carry out our wills. Venezuela. Venezuela is an incredible issue because I was even tricked by the propaganda before I went. You know, it's hard. Even as a media analyst for 10 years, it's really hard to go against just this uniform grain of just 100% one line. Everyone is starving. Maduro's a totalitarian dictator who's murdering protesters in the street. So I went there with my own eyes to see that actually there's a huge part of the story that is not being told, and that's obviously not true, what I just said about the propaganda. You know, just a couple things that go contrary to this. I mean, tens of thousands of people, yes, they were in the street protesting Maduro, but there's also tens of thousands of people in the streets pro-government. They're actually in support of the government there. The people that you don't see on the news are the black and indigenous people, tens of thousands, if not millions of people who are completely supportive of the government. Chavismo is a very vibrant, strong political force that you just see all over the country. And, you know, I interviewed people who will never be seen in the Western media, these people who would die for the cause. They were so conscious of imperialism, they knew more about our history than anyone that I would pull off a U.S. street. It was quite astounding, the political consciousness of a country that is constantly under threat of being overthrown. Like Lee was saying, their elections are free, actually way more transparent than ours. Every vote is audited. And the media is actually mostly private and very anti-government. The supermarkets aren't empty like The Walking Dead. There's a shortage of very specific items, and this is an economic war going on that you can look at my documentaries on the Empire Files to learn more. But one thing that really bothers me about like places like Vice, you know, they go and they embed themselves in the front line, the contingent of the protesters with masks, throwing Molotov cocktails, burning building down, and they never actually interview these people and say, like, what are you doing and why, right? So I actually did that. Wow, was it interesting. A lot of these people are, you know, that basically what they told me, one guy was holding a Molotov cocktail and I was just like, what are you, you know, why are you doing this? And he was like, I can't be an entrepreneur here. And I was like, that's why you're going to burn down a food distribution warehouse, is because you can't own a business in Venezuela? A lot of them just kind of sounded like they didn't know what the f*** they were doing and why they were doing it. So instead of glorifying these people, you know, we talked truthfully about what was happening, how that night that I was embedded with the protests, I saw them commandeer several 18-wheeler trucks, set up flaming barricades on the freeway, motorcycles were being driven off the road, no arrests that night. They did tell us, film what the government does to us, not what we do. And I had to tell them, you know, I'm American media, I support you guys, because it was so intense and threatening, and I know how much they hate Telesur. Because really what this is, the front lines of the protests, there are fascist contingent that actually burns people alive. Several Chavistas and black Venezuelans were burned alive. That is fascist. That is a fascist characteristic of a movement. So I'm not talking about the majority of the protesters. I'm talking about the people who are glorified by entities like Vice. And it makes me sick because I was actually chased out of the country by a virtual lynch mob for literally just talking about the fact that they were killing people. When you look at that death toll in Venezuela, the majority of the deaths were the result of the protesters either executing people, the flaming barricades, etc. So we got chased out, and after we did, our colleague from Telesur was actually shot in the back by one of these protesters there. You know, as much as we hear about Venezuela, we never hear about Colombia, its neighbor. This border is very porous. It's actually the most dangerous country in the world for unionists. Teachers. I met teachers there who had to live in exile because of these paramilitary death squads that the U.S. basically fomented for the last 50 years. We've poured $10 billion into that country, and the Kennedy Doctrine created the paramilitary death squads that had disappeared tens of thousands of leftists and peasants. And the government, as much as they want to bemoan FARC, they are stooges, not only with the U.S., but with actual paramilitary drug runners and drug cartels. So, again, the framing, the missing context between all these countries. What do they have in common? That's why I'm an advocacy journalist. We don't have time. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to be objective. I'm going to sit here, lay my heart out on my sleeve, and say what I'm advocating for. I'm advocating for marginalized and oppressed people around the world to take back their agency from what we have subjugated them. I'm debunking the propaganda and exposing the truth because that can make a great impact, because the crimes of U.S. empire and its junior partners are only exposed through the work of brave activists and brave journalists. It has the potential to stop wars. This has the potential to strengthen social movements. We have to have an informed populace in order to end empire, right? We need a critical mass here. But first, we need to inform people about what the hell is going on. That's why political education is key. History is instructive. We need to understand how we got here so we can prevent further atrocities, further wars. We need journalists who are unafraid to call out the violent economic oppression of capitalism. We must hold the power brokers accountable for their words, deeds, and crimes. And as an American journalist, sure as hell believe that I am focused on ending the U.S. empire, the world's greatest source of suffering, the greatest threat to peace around the world, because it's our best hope to enrich millions of people and build an actual just and equitable future. Thanks so much.
That was Abby Martin on global conflict and independent media. She spoke on May 11, 2018, at the Conference of the Union for Democratic Communications in Chicago. Abby Martin is host of The Empire Files, an investigative news program on the satellite network Telesur English. She was formerly host of Breaking the Set on Russia Today, RT, working from the Washington, D.C. bureau. She's an artist and activist and co-founded the citizen journalism website Media Roots. She serves on the board of directors for the Media Freedom Foundation, which manages Project Censored. My thanks go out to the Union for Democratic Communications and to Dale Lehman from WZRD Chicago for the recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
And you're back. It is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. We will be speaking shortly with Rick Sterling. He writes often for Consortium News elsewhere. He just put his name in, Rick Sterling, Sirius Solidarity Network. I was commenting on Gaza at the top of the show. I want to say that I think everyone knows that a Canadian doctor from London, Ontario, Dr. Lubani, was shot on the, I think it was the 16th. And there was a tweet from Chrystia Freeland about this, and she said, "Thank you, Dr. Tariq Lubani, for taking the time to speak to me this morning." This is after he'd been shot. And she says, then follows that with the sentence, "Dr. Lubani was injured Monday in the Gaza Strip. We are doing everything we can to help as well as to determine how a Canadian was injured." So I just wanted to help Chrystia Freeland by saying, actually, he wasn't injured. He was shot by Israeli snipers. But she can do her own research. It's been a few days, and that's still on her tweet. We're joined by Rick Sterling. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I am, Phil.
Hey, it's good to be talking to you. I saw something that was reported first, I guess, by Vanessa Bealey, 21st Century Wire. I saw it also at Charmaine Narwani, two journalists I respect very, very much. I was very struck by it. It was something, a document from the UK government, and it was about their good deeds in Syria. And it seemed to document their financing and close watch over the activity of a group called the Syria Civil Defense, or Hollywood calls them the White Helmets. If you saw that item, I want to ask your opinion of that. What are your estimate of that matter?
Well, it's a good confirmation of what Vanessa and others of us have been saying for years. That the claims of the White Helmets that they're neutral and independent, fiercely independent, they even said from government influence, is total hogwash. They're actually a creation of the UK, the US, and a foundation set up by a billionaire in the Middle East. So this is just confirming what we knew all along. The one really interesting element in this is that they talk about the White Helmets as an information source. Now, in the past, of course, they've been portrayed as these volunteers who were rescuing people. But as we've seen over the recent years, increasingly the media in the West relies on them on videos coming from the White Helmets. So they're actually funneling information and supplying videos to the West. And in this report from the UK Foreign Office, they talk about how happy they are that the White Helmets are providing this information, and they try to buttress it by saying that Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are satisfied with this and consider this reliable, and so they do too. As we know, those who have investigated the issue a lot more carefully, just about everything about the White Helmets is false. They're not volunteers. They're not neutral. They advocate for Western NATO intervention. And so they're basically paid agents. So they're supplying the information and the story that the UK and the US like to hear. Mm-hmm. This is good documentation that confirming what we've been saying for years.
I urge people to go to the I found it at a Twitter of Charmaine Narwani, and also the Twitter of Vanessa Bealey. You know, looking at it, particularly at where at Vanessa's, you see the document itself, and it says this many pounds for this work, and this many pounds for that. And then the text that you cited, and actually I have the sentence. It says, "Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have stated that SCD are their most routinely reliable source for reporting it." And then they go on to say, throughout their work, they're reporting on the Russian bombing. They specifically say that in the document. SCD has provided essential corroboration that Daesh was not targeted, but moderate opposition entities. This has provided confidence to statements by UK and other international leaders made in condemnation of Russian action. So they got what they paid for.
Exactly, yes. And that kind of lays it out there. So they've funded this organization that will...
A trifle naked, you might call it.
Yeah, exactly. And that they keep up the pretense, of course, that this is independent and this is reliable reporting coming from a neutral party, an unbiased party, which which we know is the exact opposite, because the White Helmets basically follow al-Qaeda. They follow al-Nusra, where al-Nusra is expelled from areas of Syria. The White Helmets go with them and then pop up in the next place that al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, or whichever name they're using.
Yes,
at the moment.
We had this chemical weapons episode, and it was them. Then, based on what I'm reading from the UK government itself, it was them telling the UK government, oh, the Russians, or pardon me, the Syrians have used chemicals, and therefore Mr. Trump and the Prime Minister and France have to attack them.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the other thing about this statement that's revealing is that it shows how much some of the big NGO, the billion-dollar NGOs such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, how much they are aligned with the UK and US governments on this critical foreign policy issue. Now, HRW and Amnesty and Doctors Without Borders, they certainly do good work in some areas, and sometimes they challenge the government. But what we've seen in Syria and in other places, such as Libya, where what we've seen is that the big NGOs basically align with the government. Human Rights Watch has been especially called out for that in Latin America, where you had several Nobel Prize laureates calling on Human Rights Watch to stop their pipeline between that organization and the U.S. State Department. But we see that in this statement how the U.K. government is explicitly saying how they, along with Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, get their information from this organization, which they funded to begin with.
Yeah, and it basically it is a way to shape narrative, right? They share a narrative, and they can, in the case of Human Rights Watch, I know, for example, in Gaza, people are noticing that Mr. Roth says, if Hamas is responsible, still, though, you shouldn't, you had no reason to shoot these people. Well, yeah, but he put in something which hasn't been shown. And so he's helping with the narrative.
Right.
And actually, I can recall when during the Libyan episode, the Human Rights Watch personnel were visiting the White House.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when meetings were being held about what to do with Gaddafi, Human Rights Watch actually participated in the meetings.
Right. And actually, I mean, what they called the White Helmet, White Helmets is the brand name. The organization was created in 2012, Syria Civil Defense, and then in 2013, the young marketeers based in Brooklyn, New York, thought that they came up with a better, a slicker name for the organization, the White Helmets.
Mm-hmm.
And the real travesty here is that there's an authentic Syria Civil Defense that goes back to the 1950s.
Yeah, this is identity theft at one level.
Yes. It is, exactly.
It's an imposter.
And it just kind of underscores the fraudulent nature of it and the fact that it was seriously nominated and considered for a Nobel Peace Prize just a few years after it was created by a British military contractor. It shows the influence of media and, manipulation of the public information in the current era.
Yeah. Incidentally, that this document we're talking about, which will be found at Vanessa Beely's Twitter, it says one of the reasons that they're going to continue to finance is that this has been working, that the Syria Civil Defense / White Helmets has been nominated for Nobel Prize.
Yeah, exactly. And I love the line where they say that the White Helmet information provided confidence to the statements of the UK and other international leaders. I really love how the U.S. and the U.K. proclaim themselves international leaders repeatedly, and as if the world is going to fall apart if everybody doesn't abide by the demands and of the international leader, the Washington, D.C. And just today, actually, we've got the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, giving an important talk at the Heritage Foundation, where he's issuing 12 demands to Iran. One of them being withdraw from Syria. This is they're standing truth on its head. Syria is a sovereign government. It's a member of the United Nations. They actually did have an election for the president in Syria. Most people aren't aware that they did have a competitive election in 2014. One can fault the election for various, one can critique it, but Lord knows we can critique U.S. elections and Canadian elections for that matter.
As a matter of fact, Americans are whining on both sides of the fence about their own elections, so why do they get excited about Syria?
Exactly. So it's as though Mike Pompeo is saying Iran has to withdraw from Syria. Well, what is the U.S. doing there? Uninvited, and they're the ones who have been playing footsie with ISIS and al-Qaeda, and it's the al-Qaeda organization that is closely connected with the White Helmets. In fact, the leader of al-Qaeda, the official al-Qaeda, said that he issued a statement of praise for the White Helmets, who there are their brothers in arms without, claiming they're without guns. Of course, we know from photographs and video that sometimes they do carry guns, and some of the al-Qaeda fighters
and they practice partisan. They practice partisan politics, which, aid organizations don't do that. They do sometimes comment on one problem, but they actually ask for the removal of the president of Syria and intervention by great powers.
Right. And another thing, going back a few years, Phil, is that the leader of al-Qaeda, one thing we know is that U.S. foreign policy, they always have to have a foreign person who they will put forward, and they'll put opinion pieces in the Washington Post and other influential newspapers. These opinion pieces typically are not written by the individuals involved. Mm-hmm. They're written by marketing companies. So you had Raad Saleh, who does not speak English, who's the official head of the White Helmets, in Washington, D.C. This is in 2014. A very prominent op-ed in the Washington Post calling for Western direct intervention in Syria. But it just underscores the fact that, number one, they can get on the op-ed pages of the Washington Post. Number two, the fact the statement is not even written by the people. It's written by a marketing company. It just shows how the public is being manipulated by government, by powerful forces. That want to convince us of one thing, whether or not it's true.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you about another matter, but before we move from this document, I got to ask you about this the strangulated but really fascinating language of the document. It says that we're going to continue to provide money, training, equipment, basically, and support into helping them to strengthen, this is a quote, strengthen their relationship with governance actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, actors seems to be the right word. What the heck are they talking about? Aren't they talking about those councils they tried to form where the British government was providing money to alternate governments?
That's it. Sometimes they call it civil society, and sometimes there's
governance actors. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes there's authentic civil society and authentic grassroots organizations, and then there's the AstroTurf, the foreign-funded civil society, which are basically just arms of the U.S. that are being set up for various reasons to undermine the government as part of the overall regime change strategy.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Rick Sterling. You find his articles, Consortium News and elsewhere. Just write Rick Sterling. You find all the good articles. And Rick, we had just before this Jerusalem business and all the massacre of Gaza, et cetera, there was a sharp exchange between Syrian forces, forces in Syria, and Israel. And the story here became immediately, well, it became the Israeli version of the story. And Israel said, Iranians are shooting at us. And the Iranian government, as far as I know, said, we didn't shoot at you. If we did, we'd let you know. But it's become a story. Israel now wants to pretend it's fighting Iran. What do you know about that? Can you talk about what your take on that, on the exchange of missiles?
Well, Israel has been involved in the conflict in Syria from the get-go. There was a lot of, you know, faulty analysis initially that Israel was content with the Assad government and that they weren't involved in supporting the armed opposition. But in reality, they have been involved from the get-go. They've even treated terrorist fighters in hospitals in the Golan, and they've attacked the Syrian military forces many times during the conflict. But in the last, especially in the last year, they've been underscoring that they want to portray their intervention in Israel as an intervention against Iran. Mm-hmm. So to try to justify their involvement there, as though their attack in Syria isn't an attack on Syria, it's an attack on Iran, which is, you know, 1,500 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Iran does have some forces there. It's always been exaggerated how many forces there and how influential they are. But Iran is involved in there. I mean, it was Ariel Sharon who said that the day after the U.S. finished with Iraq, they should go after Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, Benjamin Netanyahu's been after Iran for almost decades now. And he's the one who said that when you overthrow Saddam Hussein, you know, the whole Middle East is going to be a better place. And mm-hmm. we know how false that prediction was.
Mm-hmm.
But they're basically, the Israel is trying to trying to portray their illegal intervention, their attacks on Syrian sovereignty as attacks on Iran, when it's basically an attack on the sovereignty of Syria. And it was not, they've said that the missiles that were fired into the Israeli occupied Golan is coming from Iranians. But the reports that I've seen, the credible reports I've seen, indicate that it was Syrians that were sending a message saying, you've attacked us for the last several years and we have not responded, and the time has come where we're going to start responding to your attack.
Yes.
It was drawing a line in the sand.
Yeah.
And it's significant that Avigdor Lieberman and other Israeli leaders kind of quickly backtracked. They said, okay, well, we've done this. We did this attack, and we want to get that behind us. We want to end that. So I think the message has been sent from Syria to mm-hmm. Israel, saying that they may come under a much stronger missile attack from Syria if Israel continues to attack in Syria, which mm-hmm. realistically it's I think one would have to predict that that's going to happen as the Syrian government moves to retake the area near the Golan Heights, the Israeli occupied Golan Heights, and the Jordanian border area around Daraa. As the Syrian government advances there and expels the terrorists, which is happening right now, it's going to be a dangerous situation, and we're going to have to see whether Israel increases its attacks in Syria, because that may lead, and that likely will lead, to more Syrian attacks against Israel.
Which is why they would like to frame this as though they are opposing or dealing with Iran, because
exactly.
if you say Iran, of course, Iran has no claim on the Golan Heights. However, if you get into an armed fight with Syria, the Golan Heights belong to Syria.
Yeah, that's right.
And the U.S. Congress cannot change that.
Right.
This is an internationally recognized. So rather than be sort of wrong-footed by Syria in a conflict where they definitely would be in the wrong as occupiers,
right.
they would prefer to say, oh, we're fighting Iran.
Exactly, exactly. And, I mean, Iran is, for the reasons I was mentioning earlier, Iran knows that if Syria falls, if the Syrian government was to collapse and be taken, or either to break up into basically a failed state, as we see in Libya, Iran knows that it would be next on the hit list.
Yeah. Well, they've been told that. I read the right-wing commentators, they take it as though they're on a long parade to get to Tehran.
Exactly. I mean, Wesley Clark talked about this over 10 years ago.
Yeah. This is Rick Sterling. And, Rick, I have to ask you, this is pretty dramatic development. The Palestinian refugee camp, I guess that's the appropriate language, of Yarmouk has been liberated by the Syrian army, together with, correct me if I'm wrong or tell me about it, the Palestinian, armed Palestinian element.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct. I haven't seen the final confirmation, but I've seen a lot of reports pointing in that direction, that that Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters were being removed in the green buses, the famous green buses,
yes,
from Yarmouk. And if that is true, if those reports are confirmed, that'll be very good news, because this has been an area that's been controlled by jihadis and then by actual ISIS, mm-hmm, terrorists for the last several years. It's basically a part of Damascus, and it's a refugee camp in the sense that it's populated by official Palestinian refugees, but those Palestinians have all the rights of Syrians within Syria, but they retain their Palestinian citizenship, not Syrian citizenship, and they when I visited the area and I visited with Palestinians who were from Yarmouk, and they were living in either an UNRWA school area or a Syrian school area. They were talking about how they needed to get the terrorists out of Yarmouk so they could go back there. And they say, and after that, we need to go home to Palestine.
Go ahead. Yeah, and I was impressed that they're part of this fight.
Exactly.
A number of groups. Could.
Yes. Yeah. The Palestinians also in Aleppo, the Palestinian district of Aleppo was the Palestinian militias that led the fight there, and they've done the same thing in Yarmouk. So this is really good news, and that's why the Syrian army and their militia allies are moving toward Daraa and up near the border with Jordan. They're little by little, they're expelling the terrorists and allowing for the return of civilians and allow for the start of reconstruction in these areas.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Rick Sterling, and I know, Rick, you have some impressions or thought about this the Venezuelan election. Its significance. How do you view if Venezuela has been a good friend, by the way, of Syria?
Venezuela has, and I mean, one thing they have in common, of course, is that Venezuela has been a target of Washington. Washington and the U.S. media applauded and supported the coup, the 2002 coup in Venezuela. And they've been applying sanctions. They've been putting a lot of pressure, supporting opposition groups in Venezuela. And it's kind of impressive. It's very impressive, actually, to see a solid majority of Venezuelans coming out, continuing to support their independence there. The results are that slightly less than 50% voted in the election. Well, that's about the same amount as vote in the U.S., so mm-hmm. we can say that that's not very satisfactory, but conditions are bad there. They've been strangled economically. The oil prices have been very low. That's, of course, their big mm-hmm. commodity. But they have persisted, and Maduro won 68% of the vote, with a real opposition from Henri Falcon, who was a governor of a state and a former Chavista himself. But he proposes dollarizing the economy, which would basically turn it over to Washington totally. That would be a disaster. I think most of the people in Venezuela realize as difficult as the conditions are now, they would just get worse if the Washington compliant opposition took over there. So they're continuing to stand strong, and we're going to see reports coming out in the coming week from a number of commentators who are there. Dan Kovalik's there. Interestingly enough, Manuel Zelaya, the former president of Honduras, who was overthrown in the coup, he's there. Rafael Correa from Ecuador, the former president of Ecuador, is in Venezuela. They've all been observing the election and talking with people. So we're going to hear some really interesting reports coming back in the days ahead of what transpired. The reports I got last night, I got a call from a friend who was in Caracas observing the situation, is that everything was calm. The elections were proceeding normally. And then at that time, he didn't hear the results, but the results came out later on, 68% Maduro. And I've been an observer at an election in Venezuela in December 2015. Their election process puts to shame the U.S. process. They have verification. They have a paper receipt ballot that's turned in, so you can do cross-checking between the electronic tabulation and the paper form. You can do a real legitimate verification of the votes. And Jimmy Carter, of course, years ago said of all the elections they observed, the very best was in Venezuela.
Yeah, you'd be happy to know. You do know that the Canada has already announced that they, as part of the Lima group, they reject the outcome.
Right.
Something to
well, what can we say?
why don't they say we're ashamed to be members of the Lima group? That would be something. That'd be helpful.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, meanwhile, Honduras had what even the OAS was a fraudulent election last December, and the results weren't announced until January, and yet the U.S. Rushed to recognize that. I don't know if Canada held back at all on that or not.
I do not think so.
It's really sad.
They do understand American politics here. If you want to get along, you better go alone.
Right. Yep.
Rick Sterling, it's a pleasure talking to you. There's a lot of information, and we really value it, and we appreciate your writing. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Good to be with you.
Okay, Rick Sterling.
Bye-bye.
This is CIUT. It's a Taylor Report, and just to tell you, I don't know if I have. I have been asked about Larry Krotz's book. He was on the show last week, and it's called "Diagnosing the Legacy." Diagnosing the Legacy. People are asking about the title. University of Manitoba Press. This matter of diabetes 2 is something everybody ought to think about, particularly as it strikes the indigenous population. It's a very serious threat. Again, it's Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. I want to thank Febby, and we'll see you next week.